morning to the Saturday, October 6, 2012 meeting of the Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission. Happy to see you. All you bright shining faces in the audience coming out for a Saturday morning session. We're looking forward to the testimony that you've signed up to give us. We have a number of items on our agenda for this morning. And after we hear the staff briefing, we have a special panel set up to allow some of the interest from the Lower River to come forward and give us a sense of their perspectives. And then we'll have the public input that you've signed up to provide on the first item. I'm going to try to keep our agenda and keep our timeline to the agenda as set up because we all have a long way to go to drive back home. So I really do promise to the commission that we will adjourn promptly at 2 so you can all get on your way. And that may mean that I have to ask you all to be considerate of the time limits and considerate of the fact that a lot of people have signed up to testify. Okay, we'll get going right away into agenda item 8, Columbia River Fishery Management. This is a briefing. And to provide us with the briefing, we have Guy Norman, our regional director. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. Good morning, commissioners, Director Anderson, Deputy Director Storr. I'm going to brief the commission today on Columbia River management and discussions that have took place regarding considerations for some potential alternatives to managing the sport and commercial fisheries in the Columbia River for salmon. I'm going to start off with a brief background regarding those two fisheries. The commercial fishery became significant in about 1861. Once the canneries came into play in a large fashion, in 1866 it grew substantially. The commercial fishery peaked in about a 60-year period between 1875 and 1935. Typical landings were 25 to 40 million pounds per year. And those particular harvest rates were sustainable at that point in time because we had very productive habitat, didn't have the federal hydro system in place, and those salmon populations could replace themselves each year even with that kind of harvest. Commercial harvest reduced each decade, beginning after the federal dam construction or about World War II. And then it ratcheted down a little bit more after, or quite a bit more, after salmon were listed in the 1990s. Regarding the sport fishery, it was primarily a tributary focus until about the 1950s, when the effort started moving out into the main stem as well. The angler effort for the sport fishery steadily grew until about the 1990s. We had a downturn in the runs in the 1990s, both hatchery and wild runs, and we had several listings as well, so the sport fishery effort reduced in the 1990s. That angler effort has grown again to actual record levels after 2000. A lot of that associated with an upswing in the hatchery and healthy wild stocks. A lot of that is due to some actions that have been taken in river to recover those fish, largely hydro passage, and also some good ocean conditions as well. And selective fisheries have also increased opportunity for the sport fishery. A little more background. As I mentioned, between 1992 and 2005, we had 13 different Columbia River ecological significant units that were listed. Those are actually population aggregates within a particular geographical domain. There are over 100 subpopulations within those 13 ESUs throughout the basin that are listed with all unique genetic characteristics. So the Endangered Species Act harvest levels are set at levels that are consistent with recovery of these listed populations. There's several recovery plans throughout the basin. They entail an all-H approach, which is a comprehensive recovery that includes reductions in all sources of impacts for these populations. Harvest rates are set to fit within that comprehensive recovery plan and contribute to recovery. Challenges to the fisheries within that conservation framework. First of all, sport and commercial fisheries. I don't think there's any argument that both those fisheries are vital to the Washington and Oregon economies and the social fabric of the communities in the Columbia Basin, whether they're rural communities or metro area communities. As I indicated before, the hatchery and healthy wild runs, such as the Hanford Reach natural spawners, have rebounded since 2000. So we have lots of surplus hatchery fish, some wild fish. We have lots of surplus above the escapement needs. Those particular stocks are harvestable. The dilemma is that the fisheries are limited in access to those fish in order to meet the conservation responsibilities. So the result of that has been ESA impact regulatory conflicts that divide the stakeholders in the two fisheries. So as a result of this, Oregon Fish and Wildlife received a letter from Oregon Governor Kitzhaber proposing an alternative management approach to the Fish and Wildlife Commission, and asked the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission to work with the Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission to consider changes in policies and regulations to address some of these conflicts. The Washington Commission last month, as you know, did elect to coordinate with Oregon and elected to set up a work group to develop options and work through the process to come back to the full commission with recommendations. That work group is comprised of three commissioners from each state. From the Washington Commission, we have Commissioner Schmitten, Commissioner Mankin, and Commissioner Carpenter, and Commissioner Duvia is an alternate. There's nine advisors, four representing the recreational industry, two from Washington, two from Oregon, four representing the commercial industry, two from Washington, two from Oregon, and then one Clatsop County commissioner that is on the work group representing the four lower river counties in the lower Columbia River, Wakayakum County, Pacific County, Clatsop County, and Columbia County. And those four counties comprise what's called a fishery coalition. They coordinate monthly on fishery issues. The first meeting of the work group took place September 21 in Olympia. So what occurred at that work group meeting? First of all, both directors of the states gave an introductory purpose and introduced the process. Director Elliger from Oregon summarized the direction that came from Governor Kitzhaber. Director Anderson indicated that one of the primary objectives was to have a full understanding of everybody of the issues and the concepts that were before the work group. And staff gave an overview of the current management situation, including the policies of the Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission. There were tribal presentations that included the director of Intertribal Fish Commission, as well as the director of the Northwest Indian Fish Commission. There was a staff report that the commissioners have in front of them today, which was strategies for initial and analysis, which provided the concepts for discussion of the work group. That was built, guided by Governor Kitzhaber guidance, but then was further developed with discussions between the Oregon and Washington staff. Following that was a work group discussion of the various issues in front of them. There was a presentation by a conservation representative, Tom Wolf from Trout Unlimited. Then we broke for public comments, and we received quite a few public comments. And then we wrapped up the meeting with information requests that came from staff, some came from advisors, and commissioners on the work group as well. And those information requests are to be completed for the next work group meeting. So let me go through, in a summary fashion, the major concepts of the strategies that are in the analysis and discussion paper that the staff put together. First of all, the approach incorporates concepts in Governor Kitzhaber's proposal to the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission. And as I indicated before, it includes additional details as a result of discussions between the two staffs. It recognizes that the Oregon and Washington commissions make the final determinations on any changes to policies. And it includes a four-year transition period, which would be 2013 to 2016. The idea there is to avoid significant economic harm to the commercial fisheries. Guiding principles in the paper, number one, continue state leadership in promoting fish recovery, and that includes all of the sources of impacts, hydropassage, habitat, hatchery reform, and harvest. Make sure that we're meeting the ESA conservation responsibilities regarding harvest, and also meet the commitments to the treaty tribes regarding harvest sharing provisions. Enhance overall economic benefits of both fisheries. Develop selected gear and techniques, and phase out non-selective gill nets in the main stem. Prioritize recreational fisheries in the main stem and commercial fisheries in off-channel sites. And enhance the off-channel commercial fisheries, both in terms of production and exploring new sites. So let me explain the transition period first. So in this concept, during the transition period 2013 to 2016, there would be continued gillnet fishing in the main stem while selective fishing gears and techniques are further developed. And one of the development fisheries that we have ongoing is exploring purse seine and beach seine in the lower Columbia. We're in a third year of a study regarding that gear. Second concept is partially shift a larger share of the incidental take or harvestable surplus to the main stem recreational fisheries. Enhance the off-channel sites, which would include, as I indicated, fish plus infrastructure. Develop, evaluate, and implement additional selecting fishing methods that could be furthering the seine fishery concept, perhaps get to implementation during that transition period. We're not sure about that yet. Depends on some results of the studies. And perhaps exploring other ways to use the tangle net fishery as well. And then, of course, secure support and resources for implementation. So specifics on allocation during the transition period for upriver spring Chinook, summer Chinook, and sockeye would assign 70% of the incidental take or harvestable surplus to the main stem recreational fisheries. Currently for upriver spring Chinook, the Washington Commission Wildlife Policy operates on a base 65%. That percentage allocation changes depending on run size. For most run sizes, it's 65%. Oregon's is currently at 60%. For summer Chinook, it's a 50-50 split downstream of McNary Dam between sport and commercial fishermen. And for sockeye, it's incidental take. There's no prescribed allocation. It's a total of 1%. Right now, the sport fisheries incidental take is about 75% of the catch. Regarding Tule and upriver fall Chinook, now the fall period is a little more complex. This provision says no more than 70% of the incidental take to main stem recreational fisheries to meet management objectives, and that means the sport fishery management objectives. And also consider hatchery and reform policies from the Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission consider those in the allocations as well. In other words, the need to harvest surplus Lower River Tule Fall Chinook and Lower River Hatchery Coho as well in order to meet the provisions of the HSRG guidelines. For Coho, would assign commercial fisheries incidental take for off-channel Coho and Fall Chinook fisheries and mainstem Fall Chinook fisheries, so Coho incidental to Fall Chinook, as well as mainstem Coho fisheries when incidental take allocations are available. And I would consider that largely focused on the month of October. For white sturgeon, would hold 10% of the harvestable surplus and reserve as a conservation buffer, and would continue the 80%, 20% allocations that are currently in play. Right now, there's a 16% harvest rate on sturgeon that's employed. So certainly this 10% would be a buffer on whatever rate that the commission future policies determine. So regarding the mainstem commercial fishery during this transition period, use selected gear and techniques as available and practical. We know we have tangle nets in play right now. We could perhaps have implementation of some seine fishing during this transition period. That's still unknown at this period. Would provide additional mainstem commercial fishing opportunity when, so this is up above and beyond the allocations. Mainstem recreational fisheries are unable to fully use their incidental take or harvestable surplus. There's ESA impacts or harvestable surplus that are left on the table. The objectives for the mainstem recreational fisheries are met, and that's seasonal objectives is what this is referring to, and also to address Fish and Wildlife Commission's hatchery and fishery reform policy. Do we need to harvest more of the hatchery fish in order to meet those reform policy guidelines? So as part of this transition period, the idea would be to enhance the AFS channel site productions. So for spring Chinook, the idea would be to add another 1 million fish annually to that production, which would be, well, Oregon has already supplied an additional 250,000 beginning in 2010. Those fish should be back this year and next year. Oregon would propose to add 500,000 to that in 2013, and Washington 200 to 250,000 depending on funding. These fish would be shifted from the current Deep River program. Deep River is a site that we're getting good coho production out of that and good coho catch in the fishery, but very low spring Chinook survival and catch. It has not been a success for spring Chinook. If we are able to transfer those someplace else, we consider that an additional opportunity if we can find a place where they survive better. Coho would increase by 1 million fish annually. Oregon would look for 800,000 by 2013 and 200,000 by Washington. We already have that in play for 2013. We're replacing, phasing in Coho instead of spring Chinook and Deep River, so we're adding 200,000 Coho to Deep River. Those fish are going to be ready to be planted in 2013. And select area bright fall Chinook, Oregon would increase those select area brights by 500,000 annually beginning in 2013. They qualify that as if possible. So expanding off-channel sites during this transition period. So Oregon would seek funding to evaluate the feasibility of more commercial fishing time in the existing sites, and also expanding the commercial fishable area. So what that means is look into whether these existing sites could be expanded, perhaps some bubble fisheries around the existing sites. So that's one thing in play. And then looking at new off-channel sites, Oregon and Washington seeking funding to, you know, evaluate the feasibility of establishing new sites. I may just mention here that the original study occurred in 1994, and there were 25 sites that were evaluated, 12 of which were in the state of Washington. They were evaluating on their capacity to produce fish, rear fish, water quality, and fishable area, and also what there were test fisheries to see if there were main stem stocks that were actually straying in these areas. So out of that study, we just came with the Deep River site. Oregon has three sites on their side of the river, which makes up the Oregon side about 90% of the catch or better. There are a couple other sites in Washington that received high evaluations. One of those was Steamboat Slough. Test fishing indicated that perhaps there were too many main stem stocks, and there were also some concerns about straying fish into the Elokamon River. The other site that was rated high was the Cathlamet Channel. Cathlamet Channel, inside of Puget Island, right in town of Cathlamet, or near that. Large area, could fit a lot of vessels. Question there is whether or not you could separate the main stem stocks adequately or not. So long term, and I'll kick up the pace here on long term because a lot of it's redundant. So non-tribal main stem commercial fisheries would be restricted to the use of selected gear or techniques. Additional main stem fishing when those three objectives that I mentioned in the transition period would apply. So the allocations, spring and summer Chinook, 80% of the incidental take to the main stem recreational fisheries. Both Tule Fall Chinook and Upper River Bright Chinook up to 80%. But again, an annual assessment of fishery and conservation objectives would come into play in the fall season. The fall season is very complex, lots of stocks, substantial hatchery surplus. There's an ocean fishery connection as well. That's why we deal with it annually in the North of Falcon process. And I think we envision that there would be that same kind of process to evaluate the objectives, harvestable surplus, ESA considerations that would occur in the fall season. And I think as part of this process, we want to flush that out a little bit further to see what that would look like. Continuing with the long-term coho, it's the same provision that we had in the transition period, and white sturgeon is as well. So in the enhanced production, spring Chinook would be increased by 1.25 million. So an additional 250,000 besides what happens during the transition period from Oregon. Coho increasing by 4.8 million annually. And so on top of the 1 million that would be in the transmission period, Oregon would look for another 3.8 million. And select area brights, 750,000 new fish. So in addition to the 500,000 in the transition period, another 250,000. I just want to compare those numbers with the current. So let me go back a minute. And so spring Chinook is currently 1.5 million. And so that'd be 1.25 million in addition, so 2.75 million. Coho is currently 3.0 million, so 4.8 on top of that would move that to 7.8. And select area brights are currently 1.4 million. So that would move that to just over 2 million. So just for information here. I have a map of the current select areas, all down in the lower estuary part of the river. Young's Bay being the largest one that has the most capacity. And Tongue Point and Blind Slough, both in Oregon. And then Deep River, the only site in the state of Washington. There's reciprocity in Young's Bay. It's state of Oregon waters, but there is reciprocity. The Blind Slough and Napa Slough and Tongue Point are concurrent waters, so there is access for Washington fishermen if they choose to fish there. And then Deep River up to the Highway Bridge, or most of the fishable area, is also concurrent water, so both fishermen from both states can fish there. But over on the Oregon side, only about 10% of the fleet is actually Washington fishermen that participate. So part of the plan also has an adaptive management provision that would, where commissions would consider adjustments if these triggers occur. So let me list those: significantly lower than expected returns to the off-channel site, so the production doesn't happen or we just don't get the fish back that are expected. Insufficient space for the commercial fleet in the off-channel areas, and I think that'd be focused on Washington fishermen as well as Oregon fishermen. Significantly lower than expected main stem commercial harvest using selective gear. We've got some unknowns associated with selective gear at this point. Circumstances that delay or preclude use of techniques or enhancement of off-channel production. So that's sort of related to the not very many, as many fish as expected if we're unable to get production into those select areas. Significant lower than expected economic return to the commercial fishers. One of the principles of the Kitzhaber guidance was trying to maintain an economic balance in the commercial fishery and actually try and enhance economics of both fisheries. Any conflicts with the terms of the U.S. v. Oregon management agreement with the tribes, and then failure to meet the conservation needs. I think this mostly focused on hatchery reform policy. So as at the end of the meeting, the first work group meeting on September 21, there were follow-up tasks that I mentioned earlier, and I'll just go through those briefly. So first of all, Oregon staff was going to go back and review and clarify the additional Governor Kitzhaber guidance. He had the original letter on August 9th. His natural resource staff set a guidance letter on August 14th with further interpretation of the original Kitzhaber guidance. And then in September, there was another letter that was sent from the natural resource staff of Governor Kitzhaber. And that was actually right before September 21, so there wasn't a lot of time to go through it. So Oregon staff's going to go back, look at that, and articulate if there are any changes to that guidance or any further clarification. Describe the baseline fishery compared to the transition period strategy. So this is take a look at where we are now versus where we would be with this 70-30 concept in terms of total catch, in terms of ex-vessel value for the commercial fishery, and in terms of angler trips for the sport fishery. Clarify or describe the cost and funding sources for production shifts to the select areas. So where's this money coming from now? How much is it, and how much more is needed to do this, and where's it going to come from? Describe what the options mean relative to conservation objectives. So this has got two pieces. One, conservation associated with the incidental impacts that are allotted through the Endangered Species Act. And the other piece is making progress towards the Washington Commission's hatchery and fishery reform strategy. So two pieces of that to evaluate. There was a request to display impacts and outcomes by season and to show this fall season complexity, look at the objectives and the different parts that are in play in the fall specifically. and take a look at the fishery outcomes between the transition period and the long-term strategy. So those differences in allocation between those two periods, 2013 to 16 versus 2017 and beyond. Explore new select areas and monitoring strategies. So I think one thing that we're doing on that is taking another look at that original research that had those 25 sites and starting to discuss options that could be available to at least explore further. Think about and report how important new safe areas are for space and capacity. So evaluate capacity in the current sites and try and come to a conclusion in terms of how much new space is needed in order to provide space for the fleet to fish. Again, I think the Washington Fishers, that's a big part of that investigation. And then consider alternative gears in the fishery evaluation. So I think we're in the third year of the same gear evaluations, and only in the second year of the mortality study. And the mortality study is a big piece of this, so that we know what mortality rate to assign to released fish. I think we're going to try and do some modeling that would give us at least some concepts of how the seine fishery could play into the future in the fall for the commercial fishery. Request to coordinate with the HSRG, and that's got two parts. One part is HSRG evaluating this extra production in the safe areas in terms of potential for straying into tributaries. And we have contacted them to, and they, I believe they've started looking at that. The other part is if we're able to implement this alternative gear and harvest more hatchery fish, what are the outcomes of that relative to HSRG guidelines? And then provide the current harvest levels, both the non-Indian and Indian fisheries, and include in that the current ex-vessel values, angler trips, etc. Other follow-up tasks, one, circulate letters from the public to the work group and advisors, and we've received several of those. The commercial advisors were asked to prepare a summary of their concerns and needs and options that would meet their needs. So that's a task that the commercial advisors are asked to come back with. And then there was a site visit to the Oregon safe areas that Oregon conducted with the Oregon commissioners that are members of the work group. So moving forward, there is a website available on the WDFW website that is articulates this work group process and has additional detail, has the various reports, and has some other background reports, such as joint staff reports on the various seasons. So that's available for the public. Next work group meeting is October 18th in Portland. There's a commission briefing that would be scheduled in November. There could be recommendations at that briefing, not certain yet. There's a potential third work group meeting that could happen in late November. And then a commission meeting in December that could potentially be a decision-making meeting, but we'll see how the progress goes. And that concludes my report.
Okay. Thanks very much. Good job. It's very helpful for all of us to hear what happened at the big first subgroup meeting. Commissioner Jennings?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a clarifying question for myself. Several times in the presentation, and I'm, for example, on slide 10, but that's just one spot, or maybe slide 11, you talk about incidental take or harvestable surpluses. Are that, how do they relate back and forth to each other? Is that?
Commissioner Jennings, the incidental take is referring to the Endangered Species Act incidental impacts that are available and how that's allocated.
Right.
harvestable surplus. Spring Chinook, there's two limiters. One is the ESA impacts. The other is catch balancing with the Columbia River Treaty Tribes. And the catch balancing, how that's distributed, actually could be more limiting than the ESA impact. So it's just trying to provide for that, whichever one is the most limiting.
So whichever one is, okay, right. That was the point. All right.
Commissioner Mencken?
What would be, I think, very good for the commission to see would be for the safe areas, if you could put together a bar graph, say hindcasting to 2008, showing the fish released and the fish released at the safe areas by species, and the fish expected to return for each species as per the Kitts Harbor proposal, say through 2020. I think that would be very, very instructive.
So a current versus expected.
Yeah, just a bar graph for each year, current plus expected.
Commissioner Schmitten?
Thank you, Chair. Just to follow up with a request, for many of us, we're used to dealing with numbers of fish. If you could take and put the ESA impacts into numbers of fish, that would be helpful.
Commissioner Dubia?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Excuse me. Just for clarity for the public as well as the full commission, this is just the beginning of a possible solution, an alternative that we're exploring. We'll look at how we can improve, enhance, or modify this over the next month or two. And it is our intent from both Oregon and Washington from the first meeting that we will make a decision in December, if it's all possible, and that the optimizing the economic values of our choice is still one of the difficult areas that we'll be exploring to look at how each of the proposals net out from an economic basis to the value of both states. So that's not really too touched in too many of these places yet.
Director Anderson?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I have a few questions, if I may. They're primarily around funding and as well as feasibility. I apologize that I didn't tell you the questions I was going to ask you before I asked them, and I don't necessarily expect you to have answers for all of them, but they're things that I think are important to think about. The first one, the current funding for the safe area production, a significant portion of it comes from BPA. And I don't know exactly what the number is. So one question is, do you know what approximately the amount of money that BPA is currently putting forth for that production? And secondly, they've indicated that they intend to terminate that funding, I believe, in 2015. So I wondered if you could speak to those two pieces.
Director Anderson, in terms of the overall BPA funding, I don't have a handle on the Oregon side. I do know that the cost on the Washington side is $568,000 per year. And that's not just fish production. That includes sampling, monitoring, infrastructure. I'm not sure what it is on the Oregon side, but it's undoubtedly more than that. BPA does now fund a large portion of overall select areas. There's some other funds on the Oregon side. There's local funds. There's a tax on the landings in Young's Bay, for example, that go to funding the program. But I don't have the breakdown, but that's one of the assignments we're going to come back with the answer on for the next meeting. In terms of BPA and future funding potential, there has been a review by the Northwest Power and Conservation Council of their programs. There was a an intent to phase out that program that was represented through the council. It's not a final decision. We have been in discussions with BPA about the importance of that program, in particular related to their off-site mitigation obligations with their dam impacts through their biop. And we don't know what the end result of those discussions are. I think it is correct that it's certainly at risk.
And then the next question I had on, and you don't need to go to this, but on slide 15, it talked about the exploration and development analysis of new off-channel sites. You mentioned two potential ones, Cathlamet and Steamboat Slough. And in that slide, it said seek funding for that evaluation. Has there been any discussion about seek funding from what source?
Director Anderson, no. It's one potential source is obviously the one we just discussed, which is you know, Fish and Wildlife Program of BPA related to the investigation of alternative gear in select areas that could be connected to their obligations. But I think in terms of the dollars for investigation, I think it's related to monitoring the capacity to produce fish, infrastructure, and then perhaps test fishing to see what the potential interception of main stem stocks are in particular areas. But no, we haven't nailed down a source.
And then on slide 14, it went through, and this again is in the transition period, enhanced production in off-channel sites. And it talked about, on the Washington side, spring Chinook, 200,000 to 250,000, with a note that that depends on funding. And again, any thoughts about what funding source there might be on that production, and any estimate on the amount of money we're talking about for that piece?
So we have looked into that a little deeper. So those are part of the fish that would have been scheduled to go to Deep River. And as I indicated, we're transitioning to coho because of the poor survival of spring Chinook in Deep River. This would be 2012 brood, so eggs that are actually just been taken. So they would be released in 2014. Costs associated with continuing to rear those fish, about $50,000, which includes not just raising the fish, but also tagging the fish. All these fish have to be tagged in order to try and determine stray rates, etc. So overall, about $50,000. We've looked at potential Michellac carryover, at least initially, as one possibility. And you know, obviously, I think we'd put it into the conversations with BPA and the Power Council. You know, for long term.
And also on slide 14, there was a reference to the 200 on coho. There was a reference to the 200,000 piece, which I think you spoke to relative to the Deep River. And then the bottom of that slide, it talks about select area Bright Falls Chinook. Oregon would increase by 500,000 annually beginning in 2013, and then it says if possible. And is the if possible associated with funding, or is it associated with the availability of the fish to increase that production by that level, or both, or wanted to understand the caveat of the if possible?
From what I understand, it's the availability of fish, whether or not they can get that egg take, they can get enough enough return to the Kalatskanine hatchery in order to have that many eggs to take, you know, that much escapement in order to get those eggs.
Then just one last one is on slides 19 and 20. Those slides talk about increased production in the long-term piece, and there's a Spring Chinook piece, Coho piece, as well as a Select Area Bright piece, some of which is done in the transition period, but some additional production that would occur after that. And then on slide 23 is where it talked about adaptive management, which is a term that's used for a variety of different reasons, at least I've found. And the adaptive management slide seems to put some caveats around moving the solidifying that long-term step associated with ensuring that the outcome, the projected and anticipated outcomes, actually occur. And so there's the additional enhancement beyond what's anticipated in the transition period that's characterized as long-term, and then there's the adaptive management piece, which really connects back, as I understand it, to both the production, transition, and anticipated outcome during the transition period, as well as the production anticipated to solidify the long-term piece. That's all kind of captured in that adaptive management piece with some kind of caveats around it, if I understand that.
Yeah, Director Anderson, I think you articulated it the way at least staff intended this to be, in terms of that there would be an assessment of the success in moving these fish to the areas, first of all, and then if we did get enhanced production, did we have enough room for the fleet to fish, and did other aspects such as the what's left in the main stem with selective gear, what are the outcomes there? From an economic standpoint, if for whichever one of those reasons the outcome was not as expected, then there would be opportunity to circle back with commissions to look at whether or not there should be adjustments made.
Thank you.
Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Guy, for the presentation. I have four items here that I want to raise. Maybe for your task list, perhaps, if it's possible. I'd like to see some numbers as it relates to the seal, sea lion predation in both the sport and the commercial fisheries, if that's something that's available. I'd also like to see what kind of studies have been done as far as net dropouts in the gillnet fishery. I'm just letting you write a minute. I'd like also, if possible, to get a briefing on the lower river smolt mortality caused by terns, cormorants, and et cetera. I think that all fits into what we're talking about here over long term. And the last piece was I'd like to get a list of the staff that compiled this from both Washington and Oregon who have pride of ownership in it. I'd like to know who they are so we can address questions to them directly.
Director Anderson, you have a question?
I wonder if I could ask Commissioner Carpenter to repeat that last request.
What I'd like, Director, is this document that's dated 10-5 that that the guy just briefed us on. I guess I'd like to know from both departments who was involved in this, which staff were people from Oregon and Washington.
And I thought I heard a second part to that.
Well, whoever put it together has a pride of ownership in it. I guess I'd just like to know going forward, as I'm one of the participants in this process, of who the individuals were that created this.
I think we could probably answer that question right now.
Commissioner Carpenter, I think perhaps what you're referring to is the staff report that this PowerPoint was summarizing.
Correct.
September 17th staff report.
Right.
So Washington staff, myself and Cindy LaFleur, and Oregon staff, Ed Bowles, Steve Williams, Tony Nigro. There are others. Those are the principal people. I mean, there are further staff involvement in, you know, references, information, et cetera. But those are.
Was this, if I may, an in-person meeting, a conference call, or a variety of?
In-person meeting.
Thank you.
Commissioner Perry, we're next. Bring your microphone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had had one question. There are several references in to this as you went through it to using alternate gear, and I know there's been some work done on seining and so forth. Is that research ongoing? Is there other methods that are being tried out? Is that research in Oregon or Washington ongoing is the basic question.
Commissioner Perry, yes, it is. So we're in the third year of SANE studies and the second year of a mortality study. We want to do 3 years of mortality study. First 2 years, we had quite a few fishermen that were basically just looking at what is the catchability of the gear and what kind of stocks were they intercepting, and those were successful tests. They were able to catch fish, and it was in the fall period, both coho and chinook in pretty substantial numbers. What we're really focusing on getting a handle on now is long-term mortality with the release fish. Because that'll be a key to determining, you know, how many ESA impacts do you use when you implement that same fishery. So we're in our second year of mortality study now, and we plan on one more year of mortality study. Oregon is also testing tangle net fishing in October for coho as well. And so those are the two main tests that are ongoing.
Thank you.
Okay, before anyone asks more questions, I want to alert the commission to the fact that we have about an hour and a half of public input signed up for associated with this item, as well as about a 45-minute panel. So we're looking at about 2 hours of what I think is very valuable time listening to the folks who've taken the time to come and talk with us. So while this is extremely important and valuable, we can also conduct more questioning of staff during our conference calls, and we can't hear from people during our conference calls. So I'd like to suggest that we take one more question from Commissioner Duvia and then move on to the public input. If everyone's okay with that, Director Anderson.
I don't have an additional question. I do have a request, and we want to be responsive to all the questions, information requests that are coming from the commission. We have a subcommittee work group that everybody knows about. We're getting lots of information requests coming from that group. We met with the Fish Committee last night. We're getting information requests from that group. And then we're getting requests from individual commissioners during this kind of a dialogue. I'd like to try to figure out a way how to manage the information requests so that we kind of have a master list, understand what's been asked, what we're working on. There may be a need to prioritize some of these. So I just want to call that to the commission's attention, that there's lots of information requests coming in from different venues associated with this issue.
Okay, so maybe that's a good subject for the debrief at the end of the meeting. We'll figure out a way to be responsible, given the workload and the limited number of staff we have on this subject. Okay, so Commissioner Duvia, one more question, and then we'll call up the panel.
Mine's really brief, and it's not a new question. It's a follow-up to the director's questioning, and it was a takeaway from the first meeting on the with the joint commissions. The probability is what we need, the likelihood of those funding situations taking place, as well as if it's over time. I think that's the essence of not where is it coming from, but what's the probability of those things happening and when. And I think I was asked, but it appears it wasn't clear, but it wasn't clear to the director at that time. It wasn't clear to me either. So we've got to have Oregon provide it, as well as our director give the probability of the 200,000 fish here or 250 here. What's the probability of that event happening? So.
Okay. And thank you, Guy. Excellent. Report. And I'd like to call up the panel from the Lower River. We talked about this at the last meeting. Some of the parties who will be most affected by this change that is on the horizon have asked for a special opportunity to present in a more organized fashion their perspectives. So we want to accommodate that. And I've asked my old friend Bob Lake to put the panel together, and he's brought together some of the most articulate people. And I'll let you all introduce yourselves. I took your testimony forms out of the pile. That's what I was doing, because you're going to be given a special opportunity here. And I'd like to first off ask if you would like us to delay our questions until after your presentation. That tends to be more efficient, because then we don't ask you questions that you were going to take up anyway. So let's be efficient. Let them speak, and then we'll ask you questions. Okay, Robert?
Okay, that works fine for me. I'm Robert Sudar. I've been involved in the commercial industry in Washington for over 40 years as a fisherman, and most recently as a marketer of salmon off the Columbia, and first Puget Sound, then the Columbia, to specialty markets in Puget Sound area and other parts of the state. And I've been on all the stakeholder groups, and I'm also involved in the current one that's dealing with this topic. So I put together a PowerPoint where I'd like to discuss some of the existing relationships between the sport and commercial fisheries on the Columbia. I'm going to start with the spring Chinook fishery, because that usually generates the most interest, and I'll expand that into the other fisheries. And I'll describe what the sport and commercial fisheries look like now, and I'll close by comparing those fisheries to the Kitts Harbor plan. So I wanted to start by putting up this quick graphic that really both fisheries in the spring are pretty clean. It shows the harvest and the actual mortalities that each fishery uses of those ESA fish to catch their thousands of harvests. I think, you know, both fisheries do a good job in that regard. I think that we lose sight of just how many fish we're talking about, especially when we compare it to the dam mortalities in the far right column. Those are fish, ESA fish lost in traversing the dams. In the actual main stem, sharing of spring Chinook, the red line is the sport harvest, and the blue is the commercial. In most years, over the last 5 or 6 years, it's been about a 25% to 30% for the commercial and 75% to 80% actual harvest by the sport fishery. Not all that harvest happens in the main stem. It also happens in the tributaries for the sport fishery and in the select areas for the commercial. So when you combine those, it actually works out to the commercial being in the 20% to 25% overall for spring harvest, and the sport in the 75% to 80% range of overall harvest. Now, one other thing I want to talk about is how much participation really is there in the fisheries. And this looks at, the red line is the population growth in Washington over the last 10 years. It shows that our general population has been trending upward. The bottom line is salmon punch card sales, which have been trending in the opposite direction. So I wouldn't say that there's been any particular growth in activity in the sport fishery, and certainly it hasn't kept pace with the growth in the population. This chart follows angler trips, not anglers, but angler trips in the Columbia over the last 10 years. And the different colors represent different seasons, the fall Chinook buoy 10, summer trips, and the spring fishery trips. You can see that overall, as there really isn't any more angler trips now than there were 10 years ago. It did take a dip during some weaker runs, and it's come back up again, but it's really about the same amount of angler trips as it was 10 years ago in the Columbia River. Let's also talk a little bit about days of opportunity. These are 3 years where the red bars are the days open for the sport fishery in the main stem, at least a major portion of the main stem below the below Bonneville. And the blue is the commercial openings, which could be anywhere from 4 to 12 hours per opening. And we've had a steadily declining opportunity over those years as we've been trying to, actually been prioritizing sport fishing. They've been getting more and more days. The dip in 2008, partially that's a year where there was no fishing in the main stem between the middle of April and June because of the size of the spring Chinook run. But they were able to follow those fish up into the tributaries, the Drano Lake and the Cowlitz and the Willamette. So there was other fishing opportunities which we did not have to follow those main stem fish. So I want to talk a little bit about values now. I think it's, when we're talking about what the select areas might be able to provide, I think it's important that we see, well, just what are those fish worth? If you look at spring Chinook, the average main stem spring Chinook is worth about $90, and the average select fish is worth about $65. So there's a 39% difference in value per fish. In fall Chinook, it's about $38 per fish for a main stem fish and $25 for a select. So there's actually a 53% difference in those. And for coho, it's about a 16% difference. So it's not just numbers of fish, it's also how much those fish are actually worth. And in the main stem harvest, over the last 6 or 7 years, the main stem has produced about 58% of the value to the commercial fishery. And actually, over the last 3 years, as we've been further developing those markets that want our fish, that recognize the qualities, it's been about 63% of the value that's been coming from our main stem fisheries. I'd like to talk a little bit about the Kitts Harbor plan now. One of the topics is conservation. They say that the gillnets aren't compatible with conservation-based management. In reality, our gillnet harvest stays within its assigned ESA quotas, as well or better than the lower river sport fishery does. We wouldn't be fishing if we weren't meeting those National Marine Fisheries Service guidelines. I mean, that's all set up in advance. The fact that we have a fishery at all is because our impacts are within the guidelines that are assigned to us. And I put a little graphic together. The 100% would be complete use of your impacts. On spring Chinook, our lower river main stem fishery has consistently been staying within our impacts. The sport fishery has not always been able to do that. And I can show similar relationships for the summer and fall fisheries in terms of our fishery being very effective, our current fishery, in staying within the management guidelines we're assigned. Another topic was enhanced off-channel production, that they'll be able to replace the value of our fishery with main stem or in the main stem by moving us to off-channel fisheries. The majority of the value in our main stem fishery is Chinook. That's what the marketplace wants the most, bigger fish, that more valuable per pound. They like coho too, but Chinook are what really make the sales go, and that's what we get mostly in the main stem. Most of the off-channel enhancements are coho. They're not equivalent in that regard. A large increase in coho could also drive down prices. The select area fish tend to come in a smaller window. They're mostly earlies. That's going to drive the price per fish down even further. And the proposed Chinook releases will only be slightly higher, really, than some past releases. And when we talk about releasing a million fish, the return rate for select area fall fish is about 0.5%. So a million fingerlings is going to bring back about 5,000 Chinook. We're presently averaging about 6,000 Chinook in the main stem fishery, and they're worth half again as much. So there's no way that's going to be a compatible thing. In the fall, it's only 0.3%. So 0.3 million fingerlings is 3,000 fish. We're harvesting 30 to 50,000 Chinook in the main stem in the fall. 53% more valuable fish. It's not compatible with keeping us economically viable. Sport priority would increase economic value to the region. That's another topic. Overall angler participation hasn't increased in the last 10 years. I showed that in the slide that talked about angler trips. It also correlates with relatively flat license sales. There hasn't been a big surge in license sales, even though we've been working towards creating longer sport fisheries. Part or all of the Columbia is open for sport fishing almost year-round now. And staff has estimated that the way you manage the spring Chinook fishery, where most of the buffer comes out of our fishery, taking our quota and giving it to the sport fishery would only add at most a week to the spring Chinook fishery. It wouldn't give them a lot longer fishery. Our quota is not that big in the first place, and the way you hold it back for the buffer, it wouldn't provide much more time. It would take us out of that valuable fishery, which the marketplace really wants. So here's a few quick facts for 2012. This was through September 15th. That's the best data I had, which would cover our August fishery. The river's been open about 205 days for sport fishing. In that same time span, we've had 12 openings for salmon fishing. A total of 107 hours is all we've had in that long time frame. We caught 31,400 Chinook, worth $1.75 million in ex-vessel value to the lower Columbia region. If you take that to the market, it's about 358,000 pounds of fillets or 716,000 meals for Northwest families. That's fish that go to the non-fishing public. And also in terms of ecology, think what a small carbon footprint we are producing. We're catching a good number of fish, creating a lot of value, and not very many hours on the water. It's a very small carbon footprint that our fishery creates compared to the sport fishery and the way they are managed and the time they have on the water. So the conclusions I want to bring out of all of this are that the sport fishery is already getting the seasons they're requesting in most years. We have spring Chinook seasons where we talk about what do they want. They want a six-week fishery. We talk about north of Falcon. They want a certain time frame in the fall. We've been guiding that on all of these meetings to provide that fishery now. The Columbia, a major portion, is open for sport fisheries now, and they can often chase those fish further throughout the year up into the tributaries. The flat license sales and fairly steady angler trips between that 10-year span show that there probably isn't a big surge of activity that's going to happen if you're going to take our fish and give them to the sport fishery. It's mostly just going to be more fish for the same fishermen. And the increased smolt production in the select areas is not going to in any way replace our lost income if you take us off the main stem. I think that's everything I had. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Irene, you want to move the microphone over?
I have copies of my presentation.
Okay.
Thank you. A lot of gentlemen in the room today. Thank you. My name is Irene Martin. I'm a writer. I'm an Episcopal priest, and my husband and I, Gilnet, together. I've read through Governor Kitzhaber's various letters, and it seems to me that a major reason he put forth his ideas regarding Columbia River fisheries was to initiate a conflict resolution process between the in-river sport fishery and the commercial gillnet fishery. Fisheries conflicts are not a new thing for those of us who've been around for a while. In the past, there have been numerous conflicts between ocean and in-river commercial and sport fisheries and tribal and non-tribal fisheries. Spin-offs from these conflicts include current disagreements on salmon recovery. I am struck that many conflict resolution methods that have proven successful in the past were not included in Governor Kitzhaber's suggestions. These include license limitation, buyback of surplus licenses, grassroots involvement in salmon season shaping, and increasing the numbers of fish available for harvest so that everyone gets a larger piece of the pie. I believe it's worth examining Governor Kitzhaber's overarching goal of conflict resolution through these lenses to see if the successes of the past can be replicated now. Number one, license limitation. Columbia River salmon, as you know, are accessed in multiple fisheries, including the gillnet fishery along the entire West Coast. Every single one of those fisheries is under a license limitation program, except the Columbia River Commercial Guide fishery and the Inn River Recreational fishery. The regulated fisheries are, for the most part, stable, flexible, and try to cooperate with each other. Some trade fish back and forth in order to maximize value or time on the water or to access other species. License limitation for the guide fishery has been suggested before to the Washington and Oregon commissions. Without limitation on this fishery, any attempt at conflict resolution will fail, as continued pressure to meet expanding demand, whether real or perceived, will destabilize the regulated fisheries. Buyback. The most successful way to achieve license limitation in any fishery is to institute a buyback program, whereby the state purchases the licenses or businesses from the owner and retires them. If license limitation and/or reduction of the commercial guide fishery is to occur, it is reasonable for members of that fishery who wish to retire or leave the business to be compensated. Similarly, if the gillnet fleet is removed from the main stem, it is reasonable that members who wish to retire or leave the business be compensated. Grassroots involvement in season shaping. As an attendee at the North of Falcon process and PFMC meetings for many years, more than I care to count actually, I can attest to the grassroots nature and give and take that occurs as different sectors seek to find common ground in order to shape fisheries. Learning to play in the sandbox together with others is part of the responsibility of conducting viable and meaningful fisheries for everyone. Previous stakeholder processes similar to that underway now failed because some recreational groups ended their participation and walked out. Groups that choose not to participate should not be rewarded for trying to gain an advantage over groups who want to cooperate. Finally, increasing the size of the pie. The most startling omission from the Kitzhaber documents is the planned increase in production of Columbia River salmonids. The Cowlitz hatchery has just been reprogrammed to double its spring Chinook production from 900,000 to 1.8 million smolts. Chief Joseph Hatchery will take his first eggs in 2013 with planned summer Chinook production of approximately 2.65 million smolts. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers will be producing approximately 10 million additional upriver fall Chinook brights as part of the John Day Mitigation Program. And I've underlined this, it is significant to note that the funding for this production is derived from federal mitigation monies, or PUDs, through FERC relicensing agreements. No state dollars are involved with these. Mainstem fisheries, however, are the gillnet fleet's only access to this increased production. I have no reason to believe that Governor Kitzhaber was aware of this production increase when he set forth his concepts. Nonetheless, his plan essentially prevents the gillnet fishery from access to the larger pie. These are high-value fish, cannot be compensated for by lesser-value, safe area production. The governor's goals of maintaining the economic health of the commercial fishery while concentrating it in the safe areas is incompatible with this increased production regime. BPA's stated goal of ending funding for safe areas in 2016 is also incompatible with the governor's stance. I'd suggest that combining the two tools of license limitation for the commercial guide fishery and increased production should benefit both recreational and commercial fisheries on the Columbia. The increased production should mean more fish for everyone, recreational and commercial fisheries alike. License limitation on the guide fishery should stabilize this element, providing a more secure economic niche for them and reducing conflict with other users. This is the kind of win-win I think the governor was hoping for and that both recreational and commercial fishers should support. Thank you.
Thank you. Les, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commission members, my name is Les Clark. I'm one of the older fishermen, and I would try not to be repetitious. I think Robert and Irene gave you some very good figures, true to the fact, and solid figures. This year I bought my 70th commercial fishing license. I'll be 84 in December. I'm still fishing. I fish Thursday night. And I cherish my fishing as a family trade, and it's not a hobby. One of the things in our profession is that we're very restricted. And by the way, I was born in Colville, Washington, Gary's area. My mother's folks had a big ranch north of Northport. My father's had a big ranch south of Northport. And I still have a relation in Kettle Falls in that area. Beautiful area. But I've been a resident of Washington almost all my life. I'm a staunch Democrat. Still am. Still always will be. Our profession is very restricted, and there's not very much room for young people to come into our profession because it's too restricted. We need to do more for the jobs. We need to do more for the resource. And one of my main objectives has always been to do everything you can for the resource. If you take care of the resource will take care of you. And we have a lot of users. And to talk about moving one user into a mud hole is kind of derogatory. I'm sure the charter boat fishermen wouldn't want to be moved out of the area they fish. Their equipment is built for that area. It's not built for anywhere else. Ours is the same. Our equipment is built for the main stem. So to move into a select area, the select areas haven't panned out. You can raise fish in any place you want to raise fish. The numbers look very good. Those are some good-looking numbers, but they can't guarantee them. We can raise fish, we can put them out. You can't guarantee they're going to come back. Other areas are first areas to fish, and there's no guarantee you'll get them back. Another thing, if you're going to invest and put money into fish production, it makes more sense to put more money into production into the high plateau spawning areas. They're the highest quality fish. They present a fishery to more people all the way up and down the river. And the more economy that you can bring back per dollar makes more sense. The other thing is the high plateau spawners, it's very hard to get those fish to that area over all of the dams that we have and the myriad problems that we have with water quality and everything. This is nothing new to you people, but that's a public resource. The public owns it all. They're not our fish. They're not the sportsman's fish. They're the public's fish. And you people as a commission, I think, need to take a more stronger view of what we need to do for the public. That's where the funding comes from. All of the states are entitled to some of this fish when we're using federal funding. The Mitchell Act funding was put in for the commercial fishery, for the degradation of the dams. In those days, we never had a sport fishery. I like to see all fisheries share in the resource, but we need more focus that all of the groups need to live and all of the groups need to participate. So as an older fisherman that has spent all my life fishing, I really look back at what I can do for the resource, and it's a fantastic river, it's a fantastic resource. And there's a lot of funding goes into that from a lot of states, and they're all entitled to some of that fish. As Irene just said, and Robert, that we can't put the quality out of those areas. So our main objective is to produce the very best quality fish that we can get and put on the market for the public. So when we go to our legislators and talk about funding and stuff, we have to have things to back it up that really talks about what we're going to do for the public. So that's some of my comments, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Okay, thanks. Bob, we're going to reserve questions to hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I would like to thank the panel, Robert, Irene, and Les, for some real good testimony. And I'm kind of the follow-up here, and we've got a couple things I'd like to address. And Les hit on a little bit. The fish belongs to the public. And back, it was 8 years ago, I believe, the numbers that was ran, and according to what Robert had on his graph about population and such, and fishing license, punch, all totaled, the 95% or 96% of the state population does not fish for trout, bass, salmon, sturgeon, crab, nothing. Okay, so all that leaves roughly 4%. That's gill netters, crab fishermen, trollers, sport, you know, everybody is only 4% of the population. Now, if in that fact that's the case, these fish that we deliver for the public, the majority of those fish go to the consumers of the state of Washington. They're the ones that's footing the bills for the hatcheries and everything else. And they're entitled to good fish. There's no doubt about that. And also, then I would like to get into a thing here. I noticed this morning, I was on the internet, looked real quick, and this is out of the Seattle Times. Through September 30th, there has been an estimated 125,465 angler trips with 22,886 adult Chinook and 864 kept. The total preseason expectation for the lower Columbia mainstream fishery was 25,100 Chinook and 1,500 coho. That shows you right there the recreational can't catch what they're already allocated. It's the same thing in the ocean. So why don't we get back to real basics and look at the numbers and look at them accurately where we can do something with them and utilize the resource to its utmost to the citizens of the state of Washington and the small businesses. Each one of us is a small business. Myself, Les, Irene and her husband, and Robert. We are supplying fish to the public, period. And also, I'd like to put this out. The impacts on Chinook, that you see out of the commercial fishery, we're well below our limits. We have the cleanest fishery there is, there's no doubt about it, because of net size, timing, whether it's tangle nets, we have the tools. We are a lot more selective than any recreational fishery you're going to find. It's proven. You don't want to be said, but it's a fact. Also, sturgeon as well as salmon are classified as a food fish. Steelhead is a recreational fish. And something I didn't see, how about all the access to steelhead that the recreational fisheries had this year we didn't have? When I first started fishing, there was a big blow-up about steelhead on the Columbia River. And that was back in the middle 70s when I first started fishing. And I was down Chinook, and I was listening to Les talk to Kenny Greenfield. And he was talking about giving the recreational people all the steelhead. Well, that's what came about. Steelhead was reclassified as a recreational fish. We couldn't sell it. But salmon is still classified as a food fish as well as sturgeon. And all of a sudden, sturgeon, 80% is going to the recreational fleet and only 20% to the commercial fleet. This is kind of ludicrous when we're supposed to be supplying food fish to the public of the state of Washington and also Oregon and the rest of the country. So where do we go from here? I think it's time you commission members really look at it seriously and start representing the citizens of the state of Washington, period. And also, this thing is nothing but a reallocation from the commercial to the river guides on the Columbia River. That's all it amounts to. But even with the tools they have, they still can't catch a lot of fish. And it's been going ongoing for years in the ocean, as well as the inside fisheries. And with that, I've got I'd like to read a letter that our state legislators print out, and I contacted Brian Hatfield's office, And I got permission, also asked Dean Tackle, who signed it, as well as Brian Blake for their permission to read it. You know, it's a letter to Governor Kitzhaber, and I talked to a couple of your members, and you guys hadn't seen it yet. It says, "Dear Governor Kitzhaber, although it may be unusual, we three Washington State legislators are contacting you to express our deep concerns about your proposal relating to commercial fishing on the Columbia River. We represent the constituency in coastal southwest Washington State. A good number of people that we represent at Washington's capital are commercial fishermen. Respectively, we believe that your proposal has been put forward with good intentions. However, we also believe that rather than help conservation, if implemented, your proposal will harm the fishery in the Columbia River. Commercial fishing methods have undergone serious change in the recent decade. The fishery on the Columbia has been effectively managed for escapement and conservation. Your proposal will have no positive impact on conservation, despite what you may have been told. Commercial fishermen are doing an excellent job of complying with regulations. The real mortality numbers speak well for the commercial fishery. These small businesses are probably the most regulated in the country. Many of these fishing families have been doing this since before statehood. They have adapted, cooperated, and invested in substantial catch equipment and methods. Use of recovery boxes and tangle nets have been very successful and effective, and the wild fish mortality numbers have greatly diminished. Virtually all fisheries, sport and commercial, have bycatch mortalities to some degree. Most are currently using best practices that have been developed over the years. Total elimination of those mortalities is an admirable goal, but not at the expense of one fishery over another. Particularly in this case, where the in-river sport fishery continues to use barbed hooks, a gear banned in ocean sport and commercial fisheries almost 20 years ago. We request that you rethink your proposal. Please take a closer look at the real politics that are best for conservation. Please gather a variety of fishing interests, sports and commercial, tribes, biologists, the federal agencies, our constituents on both sides of the Columbia River, both states' fish commissions, and staff from both sides to learn the real numbers and to amend your well-intentioned proposal. Your plan to change the way commercial fishermen can fish will ruin them, and it will not enhance conservation objectives. There will be a joint Washington-Oregon Fisheries Commission's workshop meeting in Portland on October 18th. Our constituents will be present. We hope that work groups, stakeholders, and policymakers can find solutions together. Thank you for your time and consideration. We might grant your request. Respectfully, signed Brian Hatfield, State Senator, Brian Blake, Representative, and Dean Tackle, Representative. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, now we can ask questions. Commissioner Schmidt.
Thank you, Chair, and let me thank all of you for participating and how professional that you've provided your comments. In particular, I like the data, because the data is something that's concrete and that I can get wrap my brains around. I wanted to respond to a couple points. First, Irene, to you. It's your point two on buyback. We realized that this wasn't brought up at our first meeting. I can assure you that it is our intent to bring up that issue at our next meeting in for consideration. The next, less you somewhat obliquely than directly talked about conservation in your comments, and I appreciate that. It's certainly an area of interest for me, and I think the other commissioners. It's one of the guiding principles in the joint staff proposal, so we're going to be watching very closely what we might be able to do as far as conservation goes. And again, thank you very much.
Okay, good. Other questions? There's a lot of information. Commissioner Perry.
I just had one question. That in the slide presentation, there was a statement about the value of fish, And I think the spring Chinook caught in the main stem was estimated at $90-some dollars per... Is that per fish?
Yeah, per fish.
And that's to the fishermen?
That's to the fishermen, right. That's just the ex-vessel value. And it's a reflection of the fact that main stem fish are bigger, and they come at an early... We harvest them earlier when the market is hungrier for salmon, so the price is higher. And also, they are known as a specific product that comes off the Columbia River before anything else shows up. I mean, it's before Copper River by a month or two. And so they are just a lot more valuable by their timing and quality than the select area fish.
Just one other question. In Guy Norman's presentation before, they talked about alternative methods, and he mentioned the seining. Have you folks tried that? Is that going to be an efficient way to replace gill netting, in your opinion?
Well, I've seined, not in the Columbia. I think that there's potential to use seines effectively, but I don't think they necessarily take the place of gill nets. They're just another tool. The first year I bought spring Chinook, we had 6 inches of rain before our first opening. The river just blew out. Everything blew out. And there was so much debris in the river. The gill netters had gear that would work in that kind of water, and they were able to provide some harvest. You wouldn't dare take a seiner out in that kind of a river. It would just be hopeless. And we had a two-week season that particular year, and it stayed that way the whole time. It would have been a lost season if you were depending on seining. It's commercial fishermen have a lot of tools, and that's what seining is. It's a tool, just like gill netting is a tool. Different gear, different size gear, different locations, timing, all of those are tools that help us harvest fish and stay within our guidelines. And to me, that's what seining is. It doesn't replace it. It's just another way to, maybe it would allow us to access fish we can't access now, but I don't feel that it's a replacement.
Would any of your other folks like to comment on that at all? The efficiency or the use of that in the Columbia River?
Yeah, I would agree with what Robert's saying in terms of the issues of tools, and I think that's something that keeps getting lost in this whole thing. Fishermen are operating businesses, and businesses have tools that they use in order to make money. And different people exploit different niches. You know, some dry cleaners, for example, won't clean wedding dresses. Others specialize in them. And basically, that's what goes on in a fishing business. You choose which tools work for you, which you are comfortable investing in, and so forth. At my husband's and my age, I will guarantee you we're not investing in a seine. Too expensive, too labor-intensive, we're not going to do it. It might be appropriate for some younger people. Maybe some folks want to put together a co-op and do something like that and adapt their boats to it. We're not going to do that because it doesn't make sense for our type of business. So when you're sort of looking at this, you're not going to find the silver bullet that works for everybody. You're going to have a mix of different tools to make a fishery operate. And those tools are going to be used by different parts of that fishery in different ways in order to make a living. But you're not going to find the silver bullet that says we're going to use seines and we will achieve nirvana. It won't happen.
Okay. Commissioner Clapper, go first.
Thank you. I'd like to thank each of you individually. I thought the presentation was really, really good. Maybe a bit of an odd question, but I want to ask it anyway because it was raised by Commissioner Smith. You folks know all the fishermen on the lower river. What do you think their sense would be, or what would the percentage of those people be interested if there were a buyback opportunity?
Well, all I would say is that fishermen are frustrated by these continual attempts to move us off the river. And so they would appreciate a buyout as a last step. But they want to fish. The ultimate answer is they want to fish. They would like younger people to get involved and stay involved and keep fishing and keep providing fish to market. I mean, that's the, they'd like to be able to sell their business to a fisherman who will continue to fish. They don't want to get bought out. That's like rescuing a mountain climber because he can't get to the top of the mountain. You know, that's the last thing that he wants to have happen. But there's an interest in that. But the fishermen I'm working with are not crying for a buyout. They're crying for some consideration for what we do and how we do it effectively and why we're valuable to the public and why we should continue to keep doing that.
Let me channel Kent here for a minute. As Kent would have put it if he were sitting here, I'm an old man and my fishing days are just about over. But I want something for my community. And that's the bottom line for a lot of us. Sure, we could be bought out. We're not going to invest in Sanes. At our stage of life, it doesn't make any sense. But we do want a future for our communities. And that involves reasonable fishing businesses, reasonable access to the resources that run right by our doorstep. I think there are some people that would be willing to be bought out. My guess is they'd be our generation or older. But you still have a younger generation that wants to fish. They're all over the place. They're in our communities. And they still want to go ahead on this. And I guess that's one of the things that I want to come out of this whole process with, is a future for these communities.
Bob?
If I might respond to that, I've been through a couple of the buybacks. And the idea of the buyback was, and this comes from the department, was to reduce the number of commercial licenses to have the people left in the fishery have a viable fishery we could actually make a living on. This is what the whole idea of the buyback was. Well, all it did was cut our numbers down and our strength down. There's a few people possibly would like to have a buyback. But I'll tell you what, I don't think there's that many that really want it. And I think the citizens of the state of Washington, if you eliminate the commercial fisheries in the state of Washington, why do we have any hatcheries? Your population, like 4%, that's including the crab fishermen, all the salmon, gillnet fisheries, and trollers, and everything else. You take another 1% of that, and you're saying down to 2.5% or 3% of the population. Is the rest of the population willing to pay for somebody's fun? I don't think so. What I'm saying is, you guys are walking on quicksand here, and all of a sudden it might just blow apart. I mean, it doesn't make sense when we have a resource, and the fish are just like timber, like wheat, apples, or whatever we have in the state of Washington. It's a renewable resource. It needs to be managed and controlled. But by God, let's use it for the utmost of our population in the state of Washington.
Okay, I think we've got a couple more. Let's spread out the opportunity here. Commissioner Duvia.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I had a question on the chart, Robert, the first page there. The first column there, the commercial catch, doesn't include the take from the safe areas. The last 4 years, it looks from the numbers we've gotten, about 65% of your total harvest comes from the safe areas. So though they're worth less per fish, there's more economic value to the industry in the safe areas now. Did you not include that? Is there a reason that you didn't want?
Well, I didn't include the safe catch in the main stem data because we're talking about losing our main stem fishery, and I wanted to show why that's important. In reality, 2010 was an aberration in the select areas. They caught 23,000 Chinook and we caught about 9,000, but that's the only year that looks like that. I had other charts made up that I couldn't fit in. If you really look carefully at that data, there was one year that was exceptional. This year they fished for 6 weeks, they caught about 6,000 fish. We fished for 2 days, we caught 6,000 fish in the main stem. It is not a much larger harvest in the select area in most years than it is in the main stem. But 1 year did sway those numbers significantly. But I don't think that it's Well, for one thing, the values are different, a big difference. But also the numbers are not that impressive out of the select areas in most years.
Well, I think in 2011, the safe areas had about 11,000 fish, which should be three times more than you got in the main stem. And that wasn't really too abnormal over the last 4 or 5 years.
Well, I looked at those same numbers.
There was that one peak year, I know.
Yeah, I left that in my briefcase, but yeah. We can talk about that for the next meeting.
Yeah.
I'm glad to cover that.
Well, it's just something that we're trying to make this thing economically optimal, and we're trying to make sure you have a viable economic life thing. So I think it's significant for us to include that.
Well, I'm telling you, it's not viable economically trying to move us in the safe areas. And I would also like to point out the fish come later in the safe areas. They aren't when the market wants them. They start falling on top of Copper River, which takes over the market in mid-May. And also, you're looking at one stock of fish that you're depending on to support that commercial industry. They're Willamette fish. And what if the place in the river, in the ocean where the Willamette fish go ends up being a weak return that year, and so not much comes back? I mean, this year this year they had those 250,000 fish starting to come back. We didn't see a big jump in select area fish, despite the 250,000 fish release several years ago. Why is that? Why didn't they come back? It just, the river spreads out our vulnerability to those kind of changes in returns.
Well, we're trying to look at that significantly, but that is a major significant portion of the Oregon proposal. So, I mean, I'm trying to put my hands around that.
But believe me, I looked at what their proposal is, and I know it's significant, but there's nothing that I've found that says it's meaningful, just that it's significant to what they want to do.
Thank you.
We've only got a couple more minutes in the time allocated for this panel, so you want to wrap it up, Les?
I'd like to put a little bit of information in. You know, on the talk about select areas, the select area in Washington is very restrictive compared to the select areas in Oregon. Now, the spring Chinook production in Deep River has been a total flop. We haven't been able to get any amount of fish back to Deep River on spring Chinook. I think they're colless eggs. At one time, we had 30,000 spring Chinook surplus at Collis Hatchery. And we got in an argument over whether we're going to harvest them commercially or share with the sport fishery. So in order to try to catch, at that time, we did not have upriver stock sufficient to fish on in order to catch the surplus lower river hatchery fish that was going to the Collis. So they put a select area in the mouth of the Collis to harvest some of that surplus fish, and the sport fishery went bananas. They went up to the legislature and got a bill in immediately to restrict any commercial fishing in any of the side streams. Well, it wasn't going to be in a side stream. It was only going to be in the mouth in a certain area to harvest some of that surplus. So you couldn't catch the surplus, so they quit raising it. So Tacoma Light and PP&L got off the hook for raising fish. Now you haven't got 15,000 Lower River Spring Chinook that goes to Collis, Klama, and Lewis, which is all Collis fish in the first place. They had to close the Klama this year to sport fishing because they couldn't get hatchery escapement. This commercials weren't fishing. So to get fish back is not easy sometimes. But we lost that funding, which we never should have lost that funding. I look at the Lewis River impoundments now. They're talking about using some of the upper watershed. Well, that watershed can raise fish, but boy, those are going to be expensive fish when they're $4 or $5 a piece that are going to come back there, and we don't know if we can get them back. There's an awful lot of money being poured in there to think about using that habitat. So we need to really look at our dollar value, our contribution to our user groups and everything when we talk about some of that production. And it's not going to be easy to get money. We're looking at budget deficits and stuff and crunch time. And we're going to have to tighten our belt.
We've been tightening our belt for quite a few years. I think it's federal belt tightening time coming at us. So thank you all. You did an excellent job. Very informative, well prepared. Thanks very much. Okay, we'll turn now to the public input on this item. We have about 30 people have signed up, a little less. The commission rules are that each citizen is given 3 minutes. We have a timer, which Tammy is manning. And so when you hear the beeping noise, that means your time is up. You've used up your 3 minutes, and we'd like you to conclude your remarks. If you don't, I'll politely interrupt you. If you still don't, I'll impolitely interrupt you. So I'll call you up two at a time. That will make it more efficient. And we'd like you to sit at one of the chairs in front of the microphone and kind of speak into the microphone, but not too close. The first two are Ed Fetter and Frank Haw. If you'd come forward. Okay, Mr. Fetter.
Madam Chairman, members of the Commission, I think as some of you know, I've been directly or indirectly involved in salmon management for actually more than 50 years. You as commissioners are now in a position to implement what could be the most significant single advance in Northwest salmon harvest management in a century. Although many tend to credit citizens and officials in Oregon for getting us to this crossword, your direction and leadership played an essential role by demonstrating that there were practical alternatives to gill nets. Gear that corralled rather than entangled fish, that minimized impacts on weak enlisted populations, and allowed targeted fish to be harvested, allowing, of course, the wild stocks potentially to recover. At the same time, you fully recognize the vital role of hatchery reform for wild salmon recovery. There is no doubt in my mind that without your contributions, we would not be on this threshold of progress. I encourage you to do what you can to facilitate implementation of the reforms needed to rationalize harvest management without compromising the goals of hatchery reform. Thank you.
Thank you. Mike Condino, would you come forward? Okay, Mr. Fetter.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Ed Fetter. I live in Enumclaw, Washington. I'm a lifelong salmon and steelhead fisherman. I'm also a member of Puget Sound Anglers and the Coastal Conservation Association. This morning, I'd like to give you my thoughts on the unreported and unaccounted for mortality of gillnet dropouts, that is, fish that escape from gillnets after being ensnared. One of the reasons sports fishermen are so concerned about gillnets is that we're out on the water and we see the terrible damage that they do. If we catch a wild fish, we have to release it without even removing it from the water. Most of these fish are ESA protected and need to be released unharmed, but many of the wild fish have terrible wounds from gillnets. This is very concerning. Wild fish that escape from gillnets are unreported, unaccounted for, and because of injuries, probably will not spawn. Take a look at the photos attached, and you'll see some examples of the consequences of gillnet injury. And I've supplied all the commissioners, I believe, with photos with a paper that has photos of those gillnet injuries. These fish were entangled or ensnared in gillnets but escaped. Our Columbia River fish have to travel a long way upriver to their spawning grounds. Navigating through pinniped predators, fish ladders is tough enough without the added burden of gillnet injury. These warm water conditions make wounded fish very susceptible to deadly waterborne fungus, and virtually all salmon with moderate to severe injury fail to spawn, and 80% could die within 1 week. Even minor injuries retard sexual maturity and reduce their ability to spawn. I commend you for taking this critical task on, and I urge you to determine that all commercial fishing should be done with gear that does not damage wild fish. Thank you.
Okay. I'm not sure if I can read this. It's either Bryce or Brian. Is there
Bryce?
Okay. Bryce, Brian, okay, Mr. Cadino.
Good morning. My name is Mike Cadino, and I'm a Washington State resident. I'm also the manager of Fisherman's Marine and Outdoor in Tigard, Oregon. We employ 158 families in our locations, approximately 24% of which are residents of Washington State. For the success of Fisherman's Marine and Outdoor and its employees, your decision will protect our jobs. Our region cannot afford more failed industry. We need to grow our industry. I am here today to ask all of you for your help with future Columbia River issues and reforms. Any reforms that would expand and stabilize sport fishing opportunities would affect my life in the following ways. I've been in the sport fishing industry over 20 years in one form or another. During that time, I have felt the effects when the salmon steelhead runs have been low, seasons shortened, or not allowed altogether. During these times, my job was in jeopardy due to the effect of these. Whether my employer would cut back my hours, my job position would be eliminated, or where I would get laid off was always on my mind. It was times like this that I had to discuss with my wife of the what ifs. Can we continue financially the way we are living? Do we need to cut back spending? What if I lose my job today? Would I be able to find a job in the industry I love if the future of that industry was not clear? As a retail manager, I employ 40 employees, and the hours I can give them come from the amount of the business the company does. Plain and simple is the fact, the busier we are, the more hours I need to cover the needs of my increased customer base and the spending they do. I give my existing employees more hours, I hire new employees, but most of all, I can give my employees a more stable life. The increased customer spending also increases the amount we buy from vendors, which many of these are small local companies. They in turn can give their employees the same things I stated I can give to my employees. In short, the joint proposal mirroring Governor Kitzhaber's proposal would stabilize and expand sport fishing opportunities and jobs. It would give peace of mind to me, my family, and the families I am responsible for, and would be greatly appreciated. The economic effect this would have in the region would be huge. You just need to do the math. One employee has more money in his pocket. He can now spend that out in the community. The businesses that receive that can now go out and put that into other businesses and so on. The effect keeps repeating itself with thousands of people.
Thank you. Okay. First of all, I need to know what your last name is so I get the spelling.
My last name is Divine. It's D-I-V-I-N-E.
Okay. There. Now, what I'm going to do is give you your opportunity, and then I'm going to call a break. The commission needs a break, and then we'll come back and finish out the public input. So, Mr. Divine.
Okay, thank you, Chair Wecker and commission, for the opportunity to speak this morning. My name is Bryce Divine. I've been in the commercial fishing business since 1989. I started fishing actually in Young's Bay before it became a select area. And so I know quite a bit about the select area operations, and I've looked at this proposal, and this was, to my thinking, it's something that was proposed 10 years ago and has been done. They have enhanced the select areas. They have reduced commercial fishing in the main stem, and what we have is what we have. There's not really, they export a lot of areas. They haven't worked out. And, some of them haven't worked out and some of them have, but they're very small. And I don't know where you're going to get the real estate to carry through with this. And also, this proposal was before the Oregon legislature, and it didn't come out of committee. I mean, it's been argued, it's been, you know, it's not new. And for the governor to jump in here at this time, you know, there really is only one thing that it does, is give more fish to the sport fishery. It gives a few more impacts to the sport fishery, and at what cost? I mean, money's the issue. Both states are in dire budget circumstances. And for, you know, a few more fish of sport fishery when we're cutting things like education and, you know, jobs and vital programs to both states is probably going to be a difficult sell. And when it comes to jobs, you know, we work too. I mean, this is our job to fish. And we have uncertainties and so forth that we'd like to have cleaned up, but that's the way the world is. And, you know, there's kind of an overall trend in this country where we don't produce anything anymore. Our jobs are going overseas, and, you know, the people of the United States are unemployed or recreationalists or service industry or something, and that doesn't really take the place of real economy. And when we're catching fish, that's real economy and real production that goes toward the GDP. It's an important part of the economic fabric of these states. And also, you know, the sport fishery, I know a couple that just recently retired, and they did a little fishing in August and September. They're not particularly avid fishermen, but they caught 40 Chinook salmon between the two of them. 40 salmon. That's like 600 or 700 pounds of fish. And they're happy, and I don't blame them. They should be happy. That's very good fishing. I feel that in the sport fishery, if you can't catch your fish, you're not trying very hard. There's a lot of fish to catch and a lot of opportunity out there. And back to the governor's plan, there's so many caveats in it, from my view, that I don't know how that it can, how anything can be done. It's tied in knots, and I think it'll be a snafu from the beginning to end. So anyway, my time is up, and I'll conclude. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to take a 10-minute break, and then we'll resume. Thank you. I know you all are engaged in really important and interesting conversations, but we have lots of people wanting to testify. So we have to get back to business. And before I call up more of the people who have signed up for their individual 3 minutes, I have to explain that partly because of an oversight on my part, I wasn't real sure. You noticed that the lower river interests were given a special opportunity. I had extended that offer to the sport fishing interests and just had not heard back definitively that they wanted that that opportunity, and now I know that they do. So we're going to call up the four sport fishing panelists. I'm not sure who they are, but please come forward. And we'll have you sign up with Aaron after you've spoken. And these folks want to have their opportunity to present their perspectives. So you want to start off, Liz?
Yes, Chair Wecker and members of the Fish and Wildlife Commission, Director Anderson, we appreciate the opportunity today and apologize for the short notice. There's only going to be three of us, and we're going to keep it as fast as possible. You've had some grueling days behind you. The Association of Northwest Steelheaders, the Coastal Conservation Association, and the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association are longtime partners in the protection, restoration, and enhancement of fishery resources, and we truly appreciate the opportunity to give a joint presentation on what we consider the shared drivers in our organizations: conservation, social equity, and economics. We applaud the effort of the Commission to review the status quo management of the Columbia River harvest and the role of hatchery fish, and submit that any one of the three drivers present a perfect proof of need. for change. Combined, they present an overwhelming and compelling directive to reform management practices to provide better conservation of wild stocks, maximize the economics of the Columbia River fisheries, and alleviate the ever-growing sense of frustration over the lack of fairness with the license-buying sport fishing community. I'm going to introduce you to our first speaker, which is Ed Wickersham.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the Commission. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you today on behalf of CCA Washington. We are here to strongly support your proposed fisheries reform for the Columbia River. My name is Ed Wickersham. I'm chair of the CCA Government Relations Committee for Washington. I'm a citizen volunteer, and I receive no pay for this. My opposition to the use of gill nets comes from my experience of over three decades as a fish and wildlife officer for the state of Washington and two federal agencies. I have spent thousands of hours monitoring tribal and non-tribal fisheries on the Columbia River and Puget Sound. The experience has removed all doubt in my mind as to this fact. Gill nets are intrinsically non-selective by design, and when used to harvest salmon, their adverse impacts on bycatch, endangered fish stocks, and on other fisheries are virtually impossible to control. We believe these nets have no place in mixed stock fisheries, like those on the main stem Columbia, and our entire membership believes the same. Therefore, both personally and on behalf of CCA, I applaud the Commission for at last taking steps towards removing gill nets from the main stem lower Columbia River. We understand that harvest is only one component of salmon recovery, but it is crucially tied to other types of reform and demands attention, so that we will get the full benefits of our investments. For example, the congressionally chartered Hatchery Scientific Review Group concluded that the benefits of habitat restoration could be doubled by following HSRG recommendations. What are those recommendations? A major one is the need for selective harvest to increase escapement of wild salmon and reduce the number of hatchery salmon reaching the spawning grounds. Gill nets do not provide managers with the tools they need for targeting hatchery stocks for harvest. This is an essential requirement for fishing gear used in the lower Columbia River with its 13 ESA listed runs. So gill nets pose a risk of direct damage to our imperiled wild steelhead and salmon runs, and they also hamper managers in creating sustainable fisheries for hatchery fish that need to be removed. Gill net fisheries are also inconsistent with the Commission's hatchery and fisheries reform policy, which recognizes the crucial link between selective fisheries, hatchery reform, and HSRG recommendations. As I've testified to this commission in the past, the summer Chinook fishery, as an example, gillnet fishery, poses a deplorable bycatch problem. Recent observer data shows that this fishery lands and discards as many non-target fish as it does the targeted Chinook salmon. This fishery is conducted in warm water with no soak time limits, little monitoring, and no information on the survival rate of the discards. Even if bycatch does survive, studies tell us that salmon steelhead with moderate to severe gillnet damage fail to successfully spawn. Similar problems occur in the fall and winter mainstem gillnet seasons. Gillnets also pose a danger to our declining sturgeon populations since they catch and discard large numbers of sturgeon as bycatch. Recreational gear poses far less risk to wild fish and non-target bycatch species than gill nets. Sports fishing regulations mandate selective catch and release fishing for wild spring Chinook, summer Chinook, and fall coho. Since recreational fishermen deal with one fish at a time, proper care and handling is possible and highly effective. Compare this with most gillnet fisheries, where release of wild fish cannot be required because the gear makes that requirement impossible. So-called selective gillnet fishing is only required for spring Chinook. That fishery deploys small mesh gillnets they call tangle nets that facilitate live release, but still have a 50% higher release mortality than sports gear. Since the main stem tangle net Chinook landings are less than 5% of all lower Columbia River salmon landings, this means that 95% of lower Columbia River gill netting is non-selective. Of course, gillnetters want to focus your attention on this tangle net fishery and tout the fact that they use recovery boxes and 45-minute soak times. But remember that this only accounts for 5% of their landings. The fisheries are 95% non-selective, meaning wild salmon are harvested, sold, and eaten regardless of their ESA status. Surely there is a much better way of managing this fishery. The proposal that started with Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber is well thought out, removing the non-selective gillnet fishery from the main stem to the safe areas and utilizing the existing selective recreational fishery and possibly a new selective commercial fishery in the future will result in many conservation benefits. Those benefits include reduced handle and bycatch of all steelhead, resulting in significant benefits to wild and listed winter and summer steelhead populations. Reduced bycatch of sturgeon, resulting in reduced handle and injury to an already severely depressed sturgeon population. Reduced delayed mortality from gillnet dropouts. Current studies indicate that nearly all fish with moderate to severe gillnet damage fail to successfully spawn. Reduction in unrecorded catch and dropouts. Elimination of derelict gear with its hidden and serious impacts. Selective harvest of hatchery salmon, resulting in increased escapement of wild and ESA-listed fish. Increased productivity of wild fish reaching the spawning grounds and greater progress towards HSRG broodstock recommendations. Again, I want to applaud and thank the Commission for its leadership and in resolving this long-standing problem. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioners. My name is Brian Walter, and I'm here speaking on behalf of the Association of Northwest Steelheaders and our thousands of members in Washington and Oregon. I've volunteered with the Steelheaders for several years now, and many of you know me as their Washington State Government Affairs Director. Over the last 50 years, Steelheaders has developed a rich history of accomplishments, from establishing steelhead as a game fish in Oregon, to extensive watershed and stream enhancement projects, to winning numerous lawsuits in support of wild fish conservation, and overall supporting robust recreational fisheries. With 13 chapters in the Northwest, Steelheaders has never been more capable. A curious thing is happening with Northwest Steelheaders right now. Since the mere suggestion of a ballot measure 81 in Oregon and Governor Kitzhaber's strong compromise directive in August, our membership at the Steelheaders is growing at an unprecedented rate. Here in Washington State, our membership has more than tripled this year, and it's still only October. Our members are becoming increasingly involved, donating at levels never seen before, and most significantly, they're demanding change. It's a very exciting time for the Steelheaders, but more importantly, it's an exciting and optimistic time for what could become one of the most valuable efforts in salmon recovery undertaken. In addition to my work with the Steelheaders, I'm also a board member on the Columbia River Salmon and Steelhead Endorsement Board, where I help represent more than 200,000 licensed Washington fishermen participating in the Columbia River Endorsement Program. The endorsement stamp is now generating nearly $2 million a year for the department to use in support of projects on the Columbia River. Everything from paying the way for fish checkers to performing detailed studies on fish mortality rates. The endorsement does very good things. I can only imagine what we could accomplish with the endorsement if we could sell more of them. One fact you may notice, though, is that with just these endorsement dollars alone, you eclipse the value of all non-tribal mainstem gillnet fishery landings. And in this area of pay-to-play fisheries, the Columbia River recreational fisherman continues to carry the lion's share of the burden. Today, the Columbia River sport fishery draws more than 500,000 angler trips and brings the department over $6 million per year in license fees and endorsements, making up a very sizable portion of all WDFW license and endorsement revenue. While the mainstem gillnet fleet does not even generate enough license revenue to provide for even one single full-time employee for the department. The fact is that recreational anglers are paying ever-increasing license fees to have the fishery they are funding constrained by a gillnet fleet that is economically inefficient and unable to even remotely pay for their impacts. While increases in recreational angler opportunity have remained relatively modest on the Lower Columbia River, that portion of the agency budget has greatly increased. Something is very wrong with this picture. We continue to ask for your support of Governor Kitzhaber's plan and encourage you to move forward with moving the gill nets to the select areas. We believe this plan represents reasonable compromise that will not only support wild salmon recovery, but will also provide a meaningful future for commercial fisheries. Again, my name is Brian Walter. I live and fish in Southwest Washington. I enjoy 50 to 75 days a year fishing the Columbia and its tributaries. Many times I've sat before you here to ask the Commission to establish recreational priorities for the fisheries on the Columbia River. I believe now is the time to double down on our investment in robust recreational fisheries, and I ask for your support in continuing to turn the Columbia River into a world-class fishery. I thank all of you for your time and encourage you to proceed with what clearly is the right thing for the Columbia River.
Thank you, Brian. Chair Wecker, Director Anderson, and Commissioners, the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association urges your prompt action to resolve these conservation, economic, and social equity flaws in the current system. The Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association represents more than 300 businesses, large and small, around the region. And for these businesses, the Columbia is the backbone of the economics. It's what kicks the year off and what sets the table for a successful year for most of the businesses here in the region. The joint staff proposal that mirrors the Kitzhaber proposal represents a viable solution that will expand sport fishing economics substantially and still assure the future of non-tribal gillnet fisheries. In 2001, when the Columbia was reopened in spring and summer Chinook fishing after more than two decades of being closed, even though Washington had one of the highest unemployment rates in the nation, our industry had one of the best years ever. And in fact, if you look at your license sales, that's one of the biggest bumps you ever had in license sales. And why was that? It was because the Columbia was open pretty much through April and pretty much all the way up to Bonneville. That's prime time and prime real estate. So when folks talked about 6 weeks, we haven't been getting those 6 weeks that have generated those huge license sales and created jobs that were unprecedented in our industry. These years verified what many here in our region already knew, that Columbia salmon fishing is a growth industry, and we know we can do so much better. In Washington, sport fishing employs more than 14,000 families and peripherally 1,000 more. Preliminary reports from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service show that last year, nearly a million people, resident and non-resident, fished over 13 billion days in Washington state. There's really no other activity that matches that, and there's no other economic activity that's such an effective transfer of wealth from urban communities to rural communities. Think about a fishing guide for a second. We saw a presentation that the most valuable commercial fish, spring Chinook, brings in $90 if it gets first in market. I encourage you to look at the data on, and I supplied some of it for you in the packet, look at the data on pricing of fish. That early to market is a position, it's not a fish. If the troll fleet was in first, it wouldn't be because it was a spring Chinook, it got a high dollar. It's the timing in the market. If you look at a spring Chinook caught in the select area at the same time there was fishing in the main stem, they would get the same price. Tule to tule, bright to bright, it's about timing and species, not so much about that it's worth more in one or the other. But what I wanted to get at was that let's look at a guided trip. People pay about $150 to $200 to go fishing to maybe catch a fish. They traveled here, they got hotels, they spent money on rain gear and what have you. And that doesn't count the fact that the rest of us mere mortals are out there. For spring Chinook, we average 9 days per fish. So that only 6,000 fish that were landed in the commercial fleet would have been 56,000 angler trips. And I don't care if you take a low value of $50 in daily expenditures or other studies show $120, those 9 days are worth a fortune to the state of Washington. And we're wasting those economics currently. So
There's plenty of information about economics out there. I'm not going to plow through too much more for you. You've got the governor's study. You've got the Mitchell Act DEIS. And Rob Southwick, who's the premier valuer of hunting, fishing, and wildlife viewing in the U.S., is going to prepare a presentation for the committee to review later this year. Let's just suffice it to say that no matter by what yardstick you use, these fish are worth their weight in gold when they're put into the sport fleet. Lots of objections to the safe areas. Some people talk about crowding. In your packet, I included some pictures of Bristol Bay fishing where it's bumper boat gill netting. Truth of the matter is, no matter whether you're sport or commercial, if it's good fishing, nobody complains about the crowding. And no one complained about the crowding in 2003 when they caught 130,000 fish in the select areas, or in 2009 and 10 when it was right around 100,000 fish. Crowding is something that we all put up with to get good fishing. It's just the way it is when fishing's good. Some cast this as a rural versus urban issue, and I think Commissioner Schmitten got a taste of what fish bring to rural communities when the sockeye showed up. Our boat builders in eastern Washington, our dealers up in Woodinville, our tackle builders in Longview. These jobs in the sport fishing community really are spread out through the state, and especially in the rural areas where jobs are so sorely needed. So I'm going to leave time for questions. I'm going to answer a few of the concerns, though, that were brought up earlier. Conflict resolution is very, very important. Sometimes after spending decades trying to resolve a conflict, we just need to rip the Band-Aid off and move past. I think the evidence, I don't know how many of you have been around long enough for the coastal coho and remember the wars that went on the coasts between coho. They were reallocated, and now the coastal communities are able to work in an invested future together. They are collaborating with each other because we're no longer trying to manage an unmanageable conflict. There were some good points made about the public and what's best for the public interest. And what we know is the public needs jobs. The public needs good conservation of our limited natural resources. And they need a fair distribution of the fish. So Governor Kitzhaber's outlined a solution that addresses these key issues about what's in the public interest. The economic benefits of reforming these fisheries and creating a recreational priority is also very, very clear to see. And this priority fits with priorities we have in Puget Sound. It fits with priorities the Canadians have adopted, the nation of Ireland, and other places in the U.S. Over the last 150 years, society has changed profoundly, and so has its needs. We used to market hunt ducks. Now that industry is entirely recreational. The new modern industry with the ability to grow is the industry supported by nearly a million anglers in Washington State. The emerging societal need for better conservation, new jobs, and together with future population growth, mandate a new vision. You're in a place to do so now, and thanks to these terminal fisheries and new gear that's being developed, our commercial fishing industry will not go the way of market duck hunters. Sorry, because we can all share in this new future. Are there funding challenges? Of course there are. I mean, it doesn't matter what hatchery we're talking about, doesn't matter what agency we're talking about. We're going to have challenges for funding. You resolve this conflict, and we can put all our efforts into fixing the funding issues rather than managing a conflict. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Good job. Questions? Commissioner Schmitten?
Chair, I know every word I say takes a word away from the public, but I'll be quick then. Liz and Brian and Ed, a very, very good job. And I particularly like the economic data, as we got from the commercials. Liz, you've answered the issue on the safe areas that was posed. I had a question because the source was indicated from ODF and W. Does that include Washington and Oregon? I assume it does.
Yes, Oregon keeps most of the data on the safe areas and the harvest, and Washington supplies their share of the data to Oregon, but the data set is held by ODF and W.
Great. And then just the comment, Ed, I'm always impressed, and you give your introduction, you indicate that your years of service as a federal fish and game agent, and you said in monitoring Columbia River fisheries, that's a key issue. It was raised by the chair of the Oregon Fish Commission and put on one of our action items, was monitoring and catch accountability. Don't need an answer now, but that's an area that I support that need, and I'm looking for ways that creative people or knowledgeable people might be able to share what we could do about improving our monitoring or catch accounting. So think about that, and if you get an idea, pass it on.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any other questions? I guess you informed us fully. And again, there will be another opportunity in November.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I can answer questions off channel.
Okay, we can get back to the individuals. I'd like to ask you all to consider just telling us which side, whose testimony. You heard these extensive panels with very well-organized presentations. If you prefer to just let us know whose opinion you support and leave it at that, we would welcome that, too. But I'm not ordering you to forego what you've prepared to say. I'm just pointing out that the commission is going to be about an hour and a half behind schedule if everyone uses their 3 minutes. So with that, Darren Cruikshanks and Kent Martin, if you'd come forward.
Good morning, commissioners. Thank you for the opportunity to speak here. Darren Cruikshanks, I'm a commercial fisherman. I fish Alaska, Puget Sound, Willapa, Columbia River, and I'm also doing the tagging study for the purse seine alternative gear. First of all, I'm totally against this Kitzhaber plan or anybody that's even trying to propose anything like that. It doesn't make sense. There's no funding for it. It's all it's going to be is a slow death to our industry, and we can't afford to take any more hits. We've been under such constraints here that we're hanging on by a thread. Anyways, there hasn't been any discussion about, even if this was to move forward, about maybe expand the Cowlitz River, the Multnomah Channel, Willamette River. Those are good expansion areas for us to go and get those spring Chinook salmon. So if this does go into play, I would like to make sure that that's probably thrown in there. I don't know if that's probably more of a Oregon issue. Anyways, this has nothing to do with conservation. It's all about allocation. We all know that. We're all here, and it's always been an ongoing fight. So I just hope that you can see through all the stuff that's been thrown around here. And I'm in 100% agreeance with our commercial panel that came up here. They did a very good job. They're the most intelligent people in our industry. And I just hope that you guys look real carefully at the information they provided you with. And with that, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you very much. David Reese, would you come forward? Mr. Martin?
Yeah, commissioners, my name is Kent Martin. I'm a commercial fisherman, the other half of Martin and Martin, or sometimes known as the ecclesiastical hood ornament. The policy currently under consideration here is really curiously reminiscent of 19th century federal policies toward American Indians. Demonize commercial fisheries. Gill nets are evil. We kill beavers, otters, ducks. If you want to get rid of your mother-in-law, send her fishing with Camp Martin. We have been studied to death on this, and it's pretty damned clean. But anyway, so they're dirty. We got to put them on the reservation. The state has spent over $10 million in developing selective gear to and to everyone's horror, my God, it works. As such, the real agenda comes out. Use $120,000 technologies for mop-up, scrounging around for 30 fish a day after sport fishing goals have been met. I can't remember the last time the state kept a commitment to a commercial fishery. Again, reminiscent of American Indian policy. Take away our most valuable fish, spring Chinook, summer Chinook, upriver bright fall Chinook, and mitigate them with our lowest value catch, coho and tule fall Chinook. Hollow promises which will not be kept for lack of funding, if nothing else. I'd like to believe this pie in the sky is reality, but there's a long, sad history of precedent here, and I don't see anything different. The lack of credible economic evaluations of the commercial fishery is certainly proof of that, and that was intentionally done. Key word here, disclaimer. Finally, the commercial fishery has been intensively studied, and we have nothing to hide. Remember, the real issue here is the sport fishery wants to expand by being allowed to kill more wild fish that they supposedly so deeply treasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Steve Gray, come forward. Mr. Reese.
My name is David Reese. Thank you for allowing me to come here today. I've heard him talk about the commercial versus the sport fishery. I've heard you talk about the salmon, and that's not my concern today. My concern today started about 2.5 months ago. I went to a WDFW meeting at Mill Creek, and I was listening to Mrs. Hoffman and your biologist on the sturgeon, and I learned some interesting facts about that these particular fish only spawn every 5 years, that they have the ability, if they are harassed or bothered, they will reabsorb the eggs and go back and won't come back up for another 5 years. I understand that you have a 9.5 mile sanctuary, which I applaud you for. I would ask that you keep that sanctuary a sanctuary. Take the commercial gill nets that are allowed to go in there now and harvest the sturgeon and remove them. When I heard the facts about the data and the drop in that fishery, I made the personal choice, even though I love catching them, I love the sport of catching them, I made the personal choice not to fish sturgeon, either catch or release, or for harvest. I made that personally until the stocks have been changed. I would ask you to do something different, because what has been done, the data says that it's not working, and I would ask you to do everything you can to rebuild this fishery. My hopes is that my grandchildren will be able to catch one of these dinosaurs. That's all I have to say. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Okay, thank you. Carl Reinstra, would you come forward? Mr. Gray.
My name is Steve Gray. I've fished commercially for over 40 years. I have two sons that are good fishermen. That's what they do for a living. The gentleman beside me probably brought up a very interesting discussion on sturgeon. He has some things to correct. There's a very good sturgeon study, and I think you people have that was done out of Oregon by Tongue Point. They did hundreds and hundreds of sturgeons that were caught and tagged with the gill net. They had zero mortality. They were put into net pens, and they had zero mortality. Day after day, they were checked. He had a good thing that, yes, the area up there on Bonneville Dam where the sport fishery catches and hooks and release oversized sturgeon and are killing them needs to be addressed. That part needs to be addressed. I don't want you to think that this isn't a huge issue to the people in my community. We don't have big business. We have things like I'm one of the owners of a major cannery. Most of the time you can walk in there and I've got 100 people working there. Our business is a lot like a convenience store. You people drive by and see those all the time. Let's eliminate the gas pump at the convenience store. He sells pop, he sells food. He's out of business. Our canneries are just like a glove. You want to cut a finger or two off, we'll be out of business. We do crab, we do salmon, we do black cod, we do sturgeon. We service the public. You people represent the public. That's a huge thing. 90%+ of the people do not buy a recreational salmon license. Spring salmon, man. When we come to spring salmon season, the distributors, the restaurants, the convention centers, we don't have to worry about selling one. We've got requests for months ahead of time. When's that spring salmon season going to be? We want 20. We want 10. We want 6. We literally have to allocate them. That's your job. Don't eliminate your commercial fishery from any of this fish. 90% of the people don't buy a license. Robert Sudar showed you some excellent material. You can't sit here and not realize the sport fishery goes on almost all year. Like I tell my sons, what if you brought home a 20-pound salmon once a week? We'd eat almost all seafood. We couldn't eat it. What are these people going to do with that? The license sales aren't going up. It's the same people. There are so many issues here. I wish you folks would have some time to sit down with commercial people and understand them. We are very selective. Our tangle tooth gear is very selective. We used to, when we first started it, we would babysit in our hatch box or live tank. 6 out of 10 fish would be not marked. Now we're down to the hatcheries are marking them. We're down to 1 and 1.5 fish. I'm sure our percentages of recovery are much greater. Our handling mortality is definitely less than 14%. Probably better in a sports fishery. You want to know about alternative gear. My son and I fish alternative gear.
You can finish your sentence.
Well, there's so many things, Miranda, to go through. This is our life.
Okay.
And you people, I know you need to spend some time with us. Greed is a terrible thing. And you're sitting here watching it today. Don't forget the 90% of the people you represent.
Thank you. Okay, Brian Terabakia, would you come forward, please? Mr. Reiner.
Madam Chairman, Directors of the Commission, thank you for letting me speak. My name is Carl Reinstraw. I am a director on the Everett Steelhead and Salmon Club, one of the founding chapters of PSA, as well as president of the Snow King chapter of CCA. And I traveled here from Marysville today, and I make a number of trips down to the Columbia River each year to fish. I love fishing the river, and primarily it's because fishing up in Puget Sound is so bad. And they have a lot of gill nets up there too, ghost nets to be included. And you know, oftentimes the commission meetings, you know, I read about them and they focused on Southwest Washington and Region 5, but they stall out, you know. But the Columbia River is a critical to the eastern Washington fisheries and to the economy throughout the state, because I have a lot of friends that travel with me and come down here to fish. And oftentimes we don't catch fish, whether it's the weather or high water or whatever happens. But we still spend our money down here. We stay in the hotels, motels, eat, and pay the guides, or bring our own boats and buy gas, whatever. But, you know, the gill netters, they only get paid for the fish, you know, and we're paying for the experience. And in order to keep this economic engine of recreational fishing going and growing, we need more predictable seasons than we have now and a better chance of catching fish now and then. And also, I would ask you to go to the library. Take a look at the National Geographic magazine from April 2003. If I'd have thought about it, I'd have made copies and brought it here. There was a large expose on gill netting throughout the world. And the conclusion was the gill nets killed 75%, you know, and it's all bycatch. And we have the means and the technology to change that, and we can go to a different style of fishing, that we can manage the fish. The Colville tribes are doing very well at using their seines. I was up there this summer. I watched them, and I think that needs to happen in the Columbia River as well. And we need commercial fishing, but there's better ways to do it. And I think the old ways that were put forth in the 18th and 19th century that need to go away, and we need to start a new direction.
Thank you. Jim Wells, come forward, please. Mr. Tarabakian.
Commissioner Wecker, Commissioners, fellow commissioners, thank you for letting me testify here. My name is Brian Tarabakian, commercial fisherman, fish buyer, fourth generation coming up, also involved in the alternative gear study. I particularly are working with the beach seine. To me, I would think that the beach seine with our vessels, we don't have a lot, probably maybe 15 to 20% of our vessels that would be adaptable to that fishery. One thing I can see with that is it's going to have to be conducted in the daytime fisheries. One thing that we've experienced with that is a real, the conflicts haven't even started to me. When you start looking at seine gear, conducting it in the daytime hours, with ongoing sport fisheries that want to partake on beach lines, shorelines, it's not going to be a good mix. Another thing that you need to look at if you're going to look at viability, the mark rate. If you're going to look at the Chinook mark rate, and it's going to be an early time frame, and it's going to be a clip fish only, you're looking at a 50% to 60% throwback rate. If you have a 40% keep rate, and out of that 40%, what percentage is going to be tules? I know the answers. I think you guys want to research that. You need to also extract the jacks. These are all important things. We don't even know what the mortality rate. Some things are pointing to 20% of the mortality rate. If you look at a high unmark rate to a high mortality rate, things don't equate. The gentleman said here today that the Colvilles are ongoing with the seine fishery and it works for them. I too have been there. I know the people that did the study with it, and it does work for them. It's not going to work for us. The number one reason why it works for the Colvilles, they're working on an Okanagan stock of sockeye that is 100% kept. The only thing that they release is unclipped summer Chinook, which are a pretty low number. So when their nets burst up, they're basically brailing their fish out because they're a higher mark rate. I'm not saying that it shouldn't be used there. If it works for someone, great. I personally don't think it's going to work in a fleet process for us. That's my personal opinion. High expense to get the thing going. If you're going to look at a purse seine, very expensive. Very expensive transition rate. One thing, Mr. Carpenter, Commissioner Carpenter, you hit on something today, the birds. Predation. I'm tired of the political kick the can. Status quo. Governor Kitzhopper wants status quo. This is status quo. Raise more hatchery fish. Conflicts. We need to be working together on things like what you're saying with bird predation. I think if you fix the bird predation, you probably fixed a lot of the sea lion predation.
Thank you. Jerry Lowe, would you come forward? Hey, Mr. Wells.
Chair Wecker. Commissioners, Jim Wells, Astoria, Oregon, Salmon for All President, and I'm on the Governor's Plan Work Group. Director had a couple good questions from Guy at the start of this on funding. The answers just showed that this was basically another unfunded political mandate. And as far as select area budget, it's about $4 million a year. The first $2 million, right off the top, comes from BPA. And BPA is now cutting $90,000 from that budget starting in 2013. So funding's going downhill, not up. The Oregon Governor's plan has two main points in it. His plan is focusing on conservation of salmon and sturgeon in the mainstem Columbia River. And number two, the premise that recreational fisheries need to be enhanced beyond current levels. There's no conservation in the plan, only reallocation. If the governor called for a mandatory pass-through of fish given up by the commercial industry to the spawning beds, his plan might be valid. That's not the case. Any fish taken from the commercial industry goes to the recreational fishery catch or to surplus. The gill net does not create a conservation problem when the proper mesh size is used at the right time and area. Our constant observer coverage confirms that, and that's with state and federal observers. The recreational fishery needs no further enhancement. They started June 15th, and it continues 7 days a week till the end of the year right now. They had a long spring season. That was 6 days a week. 7 days a week in the Willamette, all spring and summer. There was four record sport fisheries last year in the Columbia River Basin, two in Chinook and two in Steelhead. It's never been better. A new record was set in 2012, this August, broke one of last year's records. Why should this be enhanced at the commercial fishermen's and the consumer's expense? In a quote to OPB, a representative from Stop Gill Nets Now said the gill netters won't be made whole by the governor's plan, but they won't be completely wiped out either. That, he said, is part of the compromise. I have been around nasty fishery politics for a long time, but I have probably never heard a more arrogant statement. Please refer to the handout I gave you. We'll just talk about that for a minute. I've been involved in this selective gear testing from the start. The first thing, this is Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife Policies in conjunction with Washington, dated September 21, 2011. The intent is not to replace gill nets as a method of commercial harvest, but to provide managers and fishers additional options for increasing access to harvestable stocks and species of salmon. The second one, after testing, they would consider the gear to be a viable candidate for implementation in addition to, not instead of, the existing gill net fishery. Final point for select areas, expanded opportunity in select areas would be in addition to, not instead of, opportunity in the main stem. That was the deal we started with.
Thank you. Melanie Stella, could you please come forward? Mr. Lowe?
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the Commission. I'm a commercial fisherman, also a buyer. I'd like to reiterate what's been said here today. For the most part, try to keep it simple and not repeat if I can. One of the things I'd like to emphasize, Mr. Duvia, on that business about finalizing this by December, I would really hope that we have the finances lined up for that final deal first. I think that's really a vague area that needs to be addressed. The other thing would I'd like to touch on, which is out of character or what I had planned, is this sanctuary for the sturgeon sanctuary in the Upper Columbia. And as never have I heard of a term misused as to call that a sanctuary, because everybody fishes in it. How can it be a sanctuary? We're utilizing it almost to full capacity since they called it a sanctuary. We have guides up there fishing for salmon using a shad for bait, with 18 ounces of lead and a big single hook in it. And enforcement can't do it. They're fishing for salmon. If they catch a big oversized, they release it, fight it out, and release it. A sanctuary is a sanctuary. Let's get everybody out of there. If it's going to be a sanctuary, eliminate the fishing in the area, commercial and sport. The other thing I'd like to touch on is the sport fishery. Is this? It has become it's an ego thing. We've twisted into an ego thing where some of these guys just can't get enough. No matter how much they get, they've got to get some more. The management and the state of Washington for fishing for salmon and steelhead in the state of Washington is perfectly legal, if you can do it, to catch 1,000 fish a year over that. Man, that's quite a bit. Some days it's 6-8 fish per day, salmon and steelhead. So I think we need to put a limit on how many, an annual limit on how many Chinook salmon a person can have. We could start with about 10. That would be, should be 100 pounds of fish per year per person. And everybody would like to have that. Plus they get all the steelhead. In finishing, I'd like to say that I'm not interested in a buyout. All right, thank you.
Thank you. Kira Dorito, please come forward. Hey, Stella.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the Commission. My name is Melanie Stella. I live in Puyallup with my husband and my son, and I am a member, I guess, of the 95%. I am a consumer. And I'm also a lifelong resident of Washington State, and truly one of the most unique and special things about this area is the availability of fresh, local, high-quality seafood. And as your average consumer, I don't have the time, and quite frankly, I don't have the inclination either, to go out and get that myself. And so I depend on the commercials to bring it to me. I feel very strongly that local seafood should not be reserved for a select few. It also should not be cost prohibitive for the average family to enjoy. And as a consumer, I won't presume to tell you how you should manage the fishery, but I will ask that you don't do so at the expense of the citizens, of the non-fishery citizens, and of the average consumer, because this resource, it belongs just as much to us, the consumers, as it does to both the sport and the commercial. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Lyle Cabe, would you come forward, please? Ms. Dorito.
Hi, I'm Kyra Dorito, and I own and operate an independent retail market here in downtown Olympia called the Olympia Seafood Company. Our business is vibrant, well supported by our community, and it's growing every year. We serve about 1,500 families every week, as well as multiple local restaurants and caterers, and we provide jobs for 6 people, including my husband and I. Our sort of purpose for existing, our kind of why behind our business, is to provide local sustainable seafood to local people. For the entire 12 years that we've been in business, we have included the non-tribal caught mainstem Columbia River salmon, and we would like to continue to include it. If we didn't have these salmon available to us, we would still, for today at least, have access to other wild salmon to provide. But fresh from Alaska and fresh from the Columbia River are two very different kinds of fresh. And there simply isn't another fish on the market like a spring Chinook. I wanted to mention to you, Commissioner Perry, that we have a wait list for people willing to pay over $300 per fish for those Columbia River springers. We start that list in January. The numbers that we've been talking about here too seem like we're talking about retail numbers in terms of the sport fishing numbers, and we're talking about X vessel prices for these commercial fish numbers, when the reality is once that $90 fish has landed for the fisherman, it continues on through markets like myself. There's fish buyers that sell to me. Everybody, there's quite a bit more money involved in those commercially caught fish than just the X vessel price. And especially with those spring Chinook, there's great demand for those spring Chinook, and often we can't meet everyone that's on our list that would like to purchase them. Supply and demand is a pretty simple formula, and I would just predict that removing an established historic supply of salmon from the equation would result in an increased price for the average consumer. And so that's who I'm here to represent today, our personal customers. The Columbia River and the amazing salmon that come from it should be a shared resource, I think, available to everyone. I very much disagree with any plan that removes the option for gillnet caught salmon in the Columbia, and I hope that you'll consider our businesses like ours and our customers, customers from young college students to our own governor. I hope you'll keep them in mind when you're making your decisions. Thank you.
Thank you. Greg Johnson, come forward.
Madam Chair,
Commissioners. Good morning. My name is Lyle Cabe, and I'm a lifelong Washington resident and sports fisherman. Thank you for allowing me to be here today and testify at this hearing. I'm in full support of the proposal to move the gill nets out of the lower Columbia main stem and allow them to fish in the off-channel safe areas. I believe this proposal is the most significant change to fish policy in my lifetime. The indiscriminate mortality of gill nets is well known. They are capable of taking the targeted fish, but the bycatch of non-targeted fish is well documented too. The nets are guilty of stressing oversized sturgeon in the spawning sanctuary, 40% mortality from handling of listed salmon and steelhead. There is also unaccounted for mortality of gill net dropouts and ghost nets. Who knows the damage they are doing? Removing gill nets from the main stem will have a great conservation effort in the Columbia River. Not only is it good for sturgeon and ESA listed salmonids, but it can be accomplished without jobs being lost to the commercial fishing community. The safe areas are a huge success. In 2010, the gillnet fishery caught 25,000 spring Chinook and 80,000 coho and fall Chinook. An 8-year average of the gillnet fishery in the lower Columbia River has more fish being caught in both the main stem and the safe areas, each producing more than the entire recreational fishery. The economic benefits to both states of moving the gillnets off the mainstream are enormous. When the gillnets are in, folks just stay home. It's not that the gillnets take every fish, but there are enough taken out that people park their boats and hang their boots up until the nets are out. When sport fishermen are plying the waters of the Columbia, gas stations pump fuel, sport goods stores sell fishing gear, motels fill up, restaurants slop hash. In a nutshell, small businesses flourish along the entire 144 miles of the lower Columbia. A recreational priority in the main stem is just the right thing to do. I'd encourage the commission to take the lead in this process of moving gill nets off the main stem and pave the way for Washington and Oregon sport fishers and hundreds of out-of-the-area fishermen to make the lower Columbia River a world-class destination for salmon and steelhead sport fishing. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Hal Menke, please come forward. Mr. Johnson.
Hi, my name is Greg Johnson, commercial fisher. I fish in Alaska and on the Columbia here. I'm an advisor and also on the Joint Commission representative for Washington. I thought today I would just give you a little update from my perspective as to the goings-on in this selective gear process that's been studied. I had two years. I was a contract beach seiner, and currently my two sons are deckhanding for the beach seiners that are trying to get the mortality rate underhand. And so my oldest boy went to college, so I had to fill in for him. And it's interesting because we're working on the beach, and I've never done that. I've been operating the boat, and so. They're up in the gorge, and it's very difficult to operate up there. And so some of the additional thoughts I came up with after doing this is that how much of the river can we actually use? The gorge area, which I would call mile 120 up, or maybe 124 up. So you're going to lose, 20 miles there. And in the lower river, you might lose 15 miles of real efficient area. You can fish in the Astoria area, but there are very, very limited areas in which you can do so, and very weather restricted. So that in itself brings issues as we decrease this river. But anyway, so can we catch these fish? Well, yes, it's a function. I think the gear can catch fish. It's proven out. But not everybody, if you try to make a gill netter, a seiner, not everybody's going to succeed at this. Some of the people aren't capable. I don't believe they don't have the vessels or the finances to change the vessel. In other words, some of these vessels are too small to use this. A large proportion of our fleet does have the appropriate size. The mortality rate, that's ongoing. Hopefully, we'll have that concluded next year. Another great need in this is the department needs to sort out the available fish to harvest so we can define whether this is going to be viable or not. You know, it's fine to say you got a couple thousand fish that you can go catch, but that doesn't cut out very well. It doesn't make it viable for us. Maybe a next step in this is to actually have a second step in this study would be to allow some fishers to actually prove it. Let them go fishing under some, you know, and prove that they can actually earn the money that in a small group situation. We still have to develop a fisheries management plan, determine the allowable harvest, what gear types will you use, both seine and beach seine? I would think so. How many participants are going to be this fishery? This fishery, we've got 500 licensed right now. It won't support that. Rules and regulations have to be developed.
Daryl Thomas, would you come forward? Mr. Mankey?
Good morning. My name's Hal Mankey. I'm from Longview, and I'm president of the Lower Columbia Fish Enhancement Group, one of 14 regional fisheries enhancement groups in the state. I'm also a board member of the Lower Columbia Fly Fishers, and a member of Coastal Conservation Association. Earlier this year, I was presented by Director Anderson the Volunteer of the Year Award for Fish and Wildlife. And I am not opposed to commercial fishing, but I am opposed to the use of gill nets and tangle nets. I have seen the damage done to wild ESA-listed salmon and steelhead while working with biologists with the department. And those are fish that don't make it to the spawning grounds and don't succeed. One of my concerns is that the wild fish are not going to make it to the spawning grounds in the numbers that are needed, and I'm concerned that the federal government may come in and shut us all down. Thank you.
Thank you. Andrew Marks.
I'm Daryl Thomas, and I'm a member of the Lower Columbia CCA group, and I wanted to restate too that CCA is not trying to stop commercial fishing. We're just trying to stop the gill nets out of the main stem of the Columbia River. The use of selective gear has been talked about, and I would think maybe one of the things they could do on the selective gear is if they can afford to get the selective gear, give them a special license that permits them to fish with selective gear in the main stem. Let the gill netters have the safe areas. So maybe it would equalize the fishing pressure that would go into these safe areas. So just a thought for you to consider. The other thing is we've got to stop the damage that's being done to the ESA-listed fish. As Hal Mankey just mentioned to you, there's a lot of those that are being observed even on in the main stem of gill net damage. So that's the main reason. We're just trying to get the conservation in. So that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Andy Mitby. Mr. Marks.
Good morning. Thank you, Commissioner Wecker, and thank you, Commissioners, and Director Anderson, Deputy Storr. Appreciate the opportunity to speak. I didn't come today with prepared remarks, but I have made some notes based on a lot of the information, and there's a lot of the information that's been heard today. The first thing I'd like to say is thank you for taking on a difficult task. I don't know who said it, but I'm going to skip that. Three things. The gentleman in the first panel mentioned that about 4% of the people in Washington fish. You don't have to go very far to do some fact-checking, and I would encourage you to do so at your leisure. Obviously, you're going to have a lot of free time in going through this. But 11.1% of Washingtonians buy licenses. That's 750,000 people out of a population of 6.72 million. That's from the economic study and Washington State data. I am in one of the activities I undertake. I am the vice chairman of the Washington Anglers for Conservation Political Action Committee. And as such, I had opportunity to chat with both gubernatorial candidates, Congressman Inslee and Attorney General McKenna. Both candidates endorse Governor Kitzhaber's plan. and that's been published, came out in the Washington Anglers for Conservation Voters Guide, and was published this week in the Real News. I'd encourage you to take a look at that. I had an opportunity to speak with many candidates for Washington state office, and also find a high degree of those people that endorse the governor's plan. The one last thing I want to say is that increasing hatchery production will definitely increase opportunity, but will likely also increase the number of strays. Therefore, that will increase the need for both selective harvest amounts and selective harvest rates. If hatchery strays can't be managed relative to natural origin spawners, the only management scheme left will be to reduce or curtail hatchery production. And in working through the advisory group for the hatchery department's hatchery action advisory plan, that is reiterated over and over again. So one thing I didn't hear in Mr. Norman's presentation was anything about selective gear or weirs in terminal areas. And I think that what that says is that this is an evolutionary process. We haven't gotten to the final answers yet, and I would encourage you to continue the process, continuing to ask questions, and continuing to work through the difficult task you've taken on. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Brooks, Eilertson, Humphreys, Mr. Mitby.
Commissioners, my name is Andy Mitby. I'm a commercial fisherman. This plan that you're trying to sell here has words in it, depending on funding, if possible, high risk to low. Doesn't sound like a very viable program if you're on my end. Let's talk about some real fish. The numbers that Guy put up, he was 250,000 fish. Those are not fish. Those are smolts, juveniles, with a survival rate of less than 1%. If we were to take his million fish and put those into the four off-channel sites, that provides less than 2,500 fish, if they're at a 1% survival rate, to each area. Now, after that's what's going to return. That's after the main stem recreational fishery, after the ocean fishery. This is not a viable argument. We will have to make some significant changes in this proposal if we are to move forward with it. I do not support it as it stands right now. I do support what Robert, Irene, Les, and Bob have said. Once again, I do not support this at all. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Heath Heikla, please come forward. Mr. Eilertson.
Chair Wecker, Director Anderson, and Commission. My name is B.G. Eilertson, Brooks Eilertson, and I was the previous tackle buyer for G.I. Joe's. And I'm really excited about the opportunity to testify here for what could be a very exciting opportunity for resource management for the Columbia River. Over the years, I've testified on behalf of my former company, G.I. Joe's. We operated 28 stores in Oregon and Washington. All of them were impacted by the draw and the lure, excuse the pun, of what the Columbia Spring Chinook fishery offered. When Springer fishermen were given the opportunity to be on the water, our stores from southern Oregon to north of Seattle to east to Tri-County, or Tri-Cities, would get a run on spring salmon tackle. In the competitive world, it was not an option to be out of the hot lure. And in a very uncertain season, it was hard to determine what exactly was the amount of tackle we needed to bring in for this. If we were out of the tackle that people were looking for this fishery, we would, in the worst case scenario, get flamed on popular fishing forums and lose credibility with hundreds of your targeted demographic. We spent millions in advertising to draw these people in for this fishery and other, you know, to come into G.I. Joe's. Decisions on how much product to bring in were made 6 months in advance of this fishery. Really, really a difficult task. In our business, as with most retailers, the only profitable months really came in during the holidays. It was great to have a nugget of business that would happen like February and March. And The spring Chinook fishery provided that spark to the business at a time when really not much was happening. Many times I've testified that the spring Chinook business was worth millions to our company, a company that had 1,200 employees in Oregon and Washington. Many of the employees were tenured and had health benefits. I've often wondered if we had the opportunity, with the proper management of a great resource and a blue ribbon fishery and the ability to promote it early in 2008, if G.I. Joe's would still be here. It's a painful thought to me personally, as it not only affected me, but 1,200 employees lived in Washington and Oregon, and then many hundreds of factory sales representatives selling fishing tackle and other gear. The spring Chinook fishery wasn't just about fishing tackle. It was about boating gear, automotive supplies. It was the perfect impetus to bring people into our stores. I didn't come here today to bash gill netting or gill netters. I came here to look for the help and answers that will protect the and grow the many sport fishing jobs that are out there. It might have saved our business and will keep the commercial community whole. Thank you for considering Governor Kitzhaber's plan and the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Rick Anderson, please come forward. And Mr. Heikkilä.
Okay, Chair Wecker, Commissioners, I'll get to see many of you later this month. Thank you for the opportunity to serve as an advisor. I think we have a long road ahead of us, but appreciate the time. So I just thought I'd, you know, in response, or not, didn't prepare remarks, but just provide a few kind of context issues. First, if you look at the 2008 economic study that the department had done, it's good to remember what we're talking about here. This is Washington numbers only, but Columbia River salmon fisheries represent 0.5% by weight of all state commercial landings and 1.5% by value. So that's Washington State of all of, and this is non-tribal only, so commercial state fisheries. I think it's also important to remember that 50% in this issue about providing fish to market, we do have a tribal fishery that is predominantly commercial in nature for a lot of these stocks, and that is providing fish to market. So as you're thinking about fish going to market, I think that's an important, those two things are important to remember, is this isn't the only source. I think you've had several folks here from the Puget Sound area, and what that tells you is how big of a driver the Columbia River is. We've actually looked at the license data going out and seeing where these people live who buy these, and you'd be shocked at the numbers. Columbia River, and that's the nice thing about the salmon endorsement now on Columbia River. We know that over 9,000 people, and we've broken it out by legislative district, for example, in the Auburn area, buy this endorsement, which means it really is a driver for the entire state going to the Columbia and tributaries. So I think it's also important to look at the revenue side of this, and I think moving forward, there's several issues. One of them would be conservation, and one of the things, just jotting notes as we were going through, was Robert's presentation on impacts, and I hear a lot about how this isn't a conservation issue. I just ran the numbers real quick, and if you removed tangle nets, which are the most selective gill net for spring Chinook, you would be talking about a 33% reduction in mortality to wild fish. So that is the tangle net, which has by far the best numbers in terms of mortality, doesn't even address summer Chinook or fall Chinook in terms of those impacts. So I think it's important to remember. There are always going to be questions regarding funding. The Bonneville number has been brought up, the $2 million per year. I, for one, think we're going to have a much better chance, and we're willing to help and already working on it, getting Bonneville to continue that funding if they can bank a 33% reduction in mortality on spring Chinook and other fall and summer fisheries. I think they're going to be much more likely to continue that funding than they would be without that. So, if I was looking at this, and these are the numbers right now, for spring and summer only, right now the averages are 73% of the value is coming out of the safe areas, and this is a compilation of 2010 and 11, and you have that sheet there. So 73% out of the safe areas and 27 out of the main stem. I want to make sure we keep those safe area numbers. So I'm out of time. We'll see you on October 18th, and thanks for your time today.
Thank you. Dean Patterson, are you around? Doesn't look like it. George Werfritz, did you come forward? And Gabe Miller?
My name is George Werfritz, and I'm the mayor of the town of Cathlamet.
I appreciate this opportunity today, and I wanted to start by conveying to you that I'm also a member of our Marine Resources Committee for Wakayakan County, and I hope within the next week we're going to be sending you a proposal, a very specific proposal, that will address what we're seeing coming out of Oregon, specifically from Governor Kitzhaber. What we will be suggesting is that you consider creating a fishery, I guess we could call it a main stem fishery. We'd like you to look very seriously at the Cathlamet Channel, and we want you to do so for four reasons. First is there's a geographic imperative. The maps that you've already seen today show how the select areas that we're talking a lot about are almost all in Oregon. The Washington coast, for geography, doesn't have good spots. Cathlamet Channel is a good spot. We'd like to suggest that we use this as an experimental area to use, try new technologies, alternative gear, and lots of other things. If we've got investments being made in the millions of dollars in this stuff, let's test it, see if it works. Third point would be to improve efficiency as defined by harvesting of hatchery fish rather than letting them get to the end and die. Four would be to sustain a historic industry in an economically troubled county. I'd like to end with just a bit on the economics of your conversation that's going on today. You really need an apples-to-apples or a fair comparison. I think you should look at entire value chains. If you're looking at commercial fish, from the time the fish is taken out of the water by a commercial fisher person to the time it is consumed by somebody at a restaurant, at a home. Because when you do that math, you get a same comparison to what we're hearing from folks that are in promoting the sports fishery. I also think that perhaps something like factcheck.org as applied to this discussion would be great, because a lot of information seems to be coming in that others are challenging. We've had a reference today to a National Geographic article that was about unregulated drift net fishing in the open ocean. You don't have unregulated fishing of any sort on the Columbia River, so I mean, whether that whole that article is valid at all to what we're talking about today, I think is dubious. There are lots of other facts. Get your facts straight. I think good data. You're all scientists. You're all you understand technology. You understand process, I think, very well. So good science, good numbers will lead you to make good decisions. And I would suggest that lastly, we feel like this is a race. You know, we heard about the governor's proposal in Wakayakan County. Our Marine Resources Committee started discussing it from the perspective of our local experience and our situation. And only now are we coming together with an idea. And I know that you're talking about a final decision in December. I would suggest tap the brakes a bit, extend this time out somewhat so we can actually have time to weigh all the different information. I know it's really complex stuff. I don't see why we have to have a sprint. Let's make it a mid-distance. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. Mr. Miller?
Chair Wenker, Director Anderson, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. My name is Gabe Miller, and I'm the fishing and marine buyer for Far West Sports based out of Fife, Washington. I've been with the company since 2007 and thoroughly enjoy what I do. We have two retail locations that include Outdoor Emporium in Seattle and Sport Co. in Fife, as well as our wholesale division, Sports Service, that services approximately 200 retail locations across the Pacific Northwest. Our company has about 250 full-time employees that are offered full health care and retirement benefits. Between the two stores, we have a combined total of almost 50 years as part of the fishing and hunting community here in the Pacific Northwest. As with any business, we've seen our ups and downs over the years. Given the fact that Puget Sound is in our backyard, one might think that Columbia Fisheries do not have that much influence on our business. Realistically, nothing could be further from the truth. During the spring Chinook run, every week that the Columbia is open, we generate between $75,000 and $120,000 in additional tackle and marine sales that we do not see when the fishery is closed. This means that we're able to bring on an additional full-time sales associates for the months that due to these increased revenues that come from this fishery. Even more impressive are the dollars generated from the fall fishery. In August and early September, when the Chinook fishery between Buoy 10 and Bonneville is in full swing, goods sold for that fishery can total in excess of over $150,000 per week. This also led to us hiring additional help for the fishing counter as well as other areas in the stores. Meaningful opportunity on the Columbia River for Chinook equals dollars in the till. Not only do retail businesses benefit from these fisheries, but so do local manufacturers of the goods we sell. Local companies such as Yakima Bait and Granger, Bomac Enterprises in Sumner, Procure Bait Company in Salem, and Oregon Tackle in Portland, as well as many others, see huge sales from these openers and end up hiring local people to make the products that they sell. In closing, I'll leave you with this. The fisheries I've spoke to have helped keep our businesses, as well as countless others throughout Washington, Oregon, and the black, during a time when many others have gone into the red. If we can continue to see increased opportunity, it will lead to healthier businesses and create more jobs, which will benefit everyone in our communities.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That concludes the public input portion of this item. Thank you all so much. You did an excellent job representing your viewpoints, very articulate and very civil, and for that I really thank you. We're way behind on our agenda. We have lunch. We're going to have a working lunch. The boxes will be brought in for the commission. I'll give you a 10-minute break. Then you have to come back, and we will attend to the other items on the morning agenda, and we'll try to be very efficient.
Very efficient.